Good morning. I'd like to welcome all of you to the November 21st, 2016 meeting of Chelan Public Utility District Number 1. This morning is a study session. This afternoon we will have our business session. I'd like to welcome everybody here. We do have a full house. It's great to see. I know we've got a lot of presentations today, and I imagine that's why such a large number of people are here. Today we have four of our five commissioners here. Commissioner Bergeron is excused. In terms of staff representation, Charles Von Reese is sitting in for Eric Walquist. Lisa Sanders is sitting in for Sheila Salmon, and Steve Wright is with us. As I said before, I'd like to welcome all of you and just provide a reminder that today's meeting is recorded. And as it is recorded, if anybody wishes to speak to any item on the agenda, that they could come up to the table and use the handheld mic or the mic on the table to introduce themselves, their name and address for the record, and then whatever input you want to provide for us. Also, like to remind people to silence their cell phones if they would. Makes for a much smoother meeting. Before we go any further, as we always start our meeting, we start with a Pledge of Allegiance and a safety minute, and I'd like to invite Ron Gibbs to come up and lead us.
I
pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning. Is this working?
Yep.
Ron Gibbs, Insurance and Claims Manager. And I chose a safety topic I thought that would be relevant to the Thanksgiving holiday. So turkey carving safety tip. So never cut toward yourself. Your free hand should be placed opposite the side that you are carving towards. Keep everything dry, including your cutting area and knife handle, so that items aren't slipping around. Keep your utensils sharp. Use an electric knife for the carving whenever possible. Use kitchen shears to cut the joints and turkey bones. And don't let children help with the carving, cutting, or chopping. If there is an accident, here are some tips to determine when to seek medical help. If you continue to bleed after 15 minutes of continuous pressure, if you are unaware of your tetanus immunization,
and when there's a puddle at your feet.
If you can't thoroughly clean your wound with mild soap and clean water, if you have persistent numbness or tingling in your fingertip, if you don't have full range of motion in your hand or finger, and finally, cross-contamination is how bacteria spreads, so keep your raw meats and poultry and seafood and their juices away from ready-to-eat food. And the four easy lessons of clean, separate, cook, and chill can help prevent harmful bacteria from making your family sick. Thank you.
So, Ron, just one additional, for whatever you do, if you're going to bleed, don't bleed on the turkey because the other folks still want to eat it, right?
I think you just microwave those seconds.
Thank you.
So, yes, and Ron's not going to be our risk manager.
Well, it's nice to have fun at the holiday season, and especially with a good topic. Very good. I always worry about that. That's why I avoid cutting the turkey. Commissioners, we have approval of the agenda. Any item on the regular agenda can be subject to transfer to the consent agenda. And if there's anybody in the audience that wishes to request an addition to the agenda, this is the appropriate time to do so. And so what is your wish on the regular agenda?
I don't have any items, but I understand there may be.
Yes.
Can you give just a couple seconds?
Gary?
Mr. Chairman, I recommend we move items 13, 14, 16, and 17 to the consent agenda.
Say those again, please.
I was going to add 12 to that, if anybody doesn't object.
13, 14, 16, and 17, and added 12.
Commissioner, I just say that we may have a visitor on 12, a public comment on 12.
Oh, okay. Okay, let's scratch that then.
Okay. So there's been a recommendation to move items 13, 14, 16, and 17 to the consent agenda. Is there any objection? If there's no objection, we will move those four resolutions to the consent agenda. Any other items from anybody in the audience that they've seen? Nobody moving rapidly to the microphone. We'll move to item three.
Okay, we want to provide an update on Project B5 through B8 at Rock Island. Brett Pickford will be presenting.
Good morning, I'm Brett Bickford, Director of Engineering and Project Management. I can't get it to go forward. Yeah, it is. Page down, right? So the purpose of today's discussion is to provide the annual check-in for the B5 to B8 modernization project, and also to follow up from the November 7th board meeting, where I mentioned the purchase of additional equipment for the 5th and the 6th units. There is board action requested today, and that's for a resolution authorizing execution of two field work orders, number 5-01 and 6-01, which would be for the 5th and 6th units of the contract 0401B with Andritz Hydro. The B5 to B8 check-in is provided annually prior to budget adoption because it authorizes additional expenditures for the project going forward. The check-in included a review of the project by Hydro Operations, Finance, Risk, Licensing and NRD, Power Marketing and Engineering and Project Management. The total costs have been estimated to be remain the same, with a project budget of approximately $121 million. The economics were reevaluated and are still positive, with an internal rate of return of about 8.3%. Work is ongoing on Unit B6, which was disassembled on schedule, and now the parts are being evaluated that are going to be refurbished. And manufacturing for Unit B7 is on schedule. The evaluation team reviewed the decision evaluation criteria, which includes impact to our customer owners, our stewardship, effects on the workforce, stakeholders, our district values, and legal. And that decision evaluation criteria continues to support the project. As part of that decision evaluation criteria, there was an action item that came out of that, and that was the need to adjust the contract schedule and pricing for the next two units to be released, which is the 5th and 6th units, to account for the B1 to B4 modernization project. Staff developed a proposal for that contract modification, which includes the release of up to $6.2 million of additional equipment in the month of December now, as opposed to next month in January, which we would have released about $19 million of equipment. For the 6th unit, we also recommend a release of about $6.2 million of additional long lead equipment instead of in January of 2018. With this proposal, we would have the contractor provide for storage of these additional items. We also had the finance department run an NPV analysis of that $12.4 million if we were to invest that elsewhere to see what that impact would be compared to what we're purchasing now. And so that came up to be a slight negative at about $200,000. The benefits and risk, however, of going ahead and purchasing the equipment now is that it reduces our contractual risk. It helps us maintain our contract rights to have that equipment delivered in the future. It also reduced the escalation on that $12.4 million. We buy it now, we get today's pricing as opposed to however it would escalate over the future when it would be bought. We also reduced our risk in that we can continue to use some of the same vendors that are providing the equipment for B6 and B7. We get consistency with some of the materials and equipment as it being same products. So we don't have to buy additional spare parts. We don't have to do additional training. It also provides some flexibility in our outage schedule. The B1 to B4 contract has not been executed yet. So we're not for sure that of when that outage schedule will be. So this allows us to pull in these fifth or sixth units and do that work anytime between now and up to 2022. Therefore, we've put together a resolution that would authorize the general manager to execute the field work order 501 and 601 for a total cost not to exceed $12.4 million.
Any questions, commissioners? Any questions from anybody in the audience? Thank you.
So we'll be bringing this as a resolution this afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Next up, we want to do the annual update on fees and charges and proposed service regulations. Kathy Melton will be presenting.
Good morning, Commissioners. Kathy Melton, Customer Service Program Analyst. And one thing I wanted to note is that when you received this presentation, it probably had a little bit of a different look than what you're used to seeing. I wanted to be sure to thank Suzanne Hartman and our talented folks in graphic design. They're trying out some new formats on our presentations to kind of give them a little bit more life. And policy discussions can be a little bit dry, so thank you, Suzanne, for trying to make this interesting. So what we're going to be doing today is going over some preview of proposed recommendation revisions for our utility service regulations policies and water and wastewater line extension policies, as well as performing our annual fees and charges update. So no action is being sought today. So these recommendations were originally processed through our policy review committee, and which is comprised of several people throughout the district, different work groups. So they've been reviewed to the point of being brought for your review at this time. So the first adjustment that we have would be adding in a specific type of property into the latecomers fee to specify that properties that are produced from boundary line adjustments would not be eligible for latecomers fees. And that's just a matter of clarity to set customer expectations.
Give a little, you know, I know what a boundary line adjustment mm-hmm. is. How does that play into the whole latecomer fee? A little more explanation would help.
Okay. It's similar to a situation where you would have like a commercial development. Mm-hmm. Those are not eligible for latecomers. And so this would be taking what would be considered a single lot once upon a time and someone purposely doing a boundary line adjustment and essentially thinking that they can get twice as many latecomer fees. With that, we did have someone who had, I believe, had inquired about that in last year and thought that they would then be eligible for twice as many latecomer fees.
Hmm. Okay.
And I can get a more precise example on that when we come back on December 5th
okay.
with the resolution as well.
Okay.
The next adjustment that we're making is to sections 32 and 37 in our regulations. And that is removing a specific type. That's the 120-240 three-phase delta service connection that is no longer offered for new connection types. We do have some connection types of that size available still out in the field that have already been deployed several years ago that continue to be maintained. That will go along with that final bullet that you'll see there of indicating the specific protection type that would need to be in place for that. But that is being removed from the regulations, which has already been done in our fees and charges as well. And next we have specifying that we need exposed conduits and then also 36 inches of working space around the meter base. That is correcting a safety concern for our crews working out in the field. There was some confusion about some of those items being able to be recessed into the walls. which makes it very challenging and difficult for our crews to perform the necessary maintenance and also have adequate working space around those items to work safely. And then we also have one change that's going to be in Section 41. Now, this was a change that was originally discussed when Rate Schedule 35 for high-density load customers was adopted over the summer. And this is requiring them to provide a new service application to staff if there's any desire for them to change their loads.
Kathy, just a question.
Sure.
Excuse me, just a question on the 36-inch working space.
Yes.
It's not uncommon for us to run electrical conduit and conduit for fiber in the same trench. So is the 36 inclusive or exclusive of our own fiber in that same space?
That is a good question. I may need to get an answer from someone that's more informed.
Yeah, Andy's moving.
Andy's so jumping. So that's yay. I'm not really sure, so I'm going to have Andy answer that.
Yeah, thank you, Andy Wendell, Director of Customer Service. This 36-inch working space is actually 36-inch working space in and around the meter base itself. It's intended to ensure that customers are not planting landscape materials or building structures or other items in front of a meter base, allowing us sufficient clearance for doing work, pulling the meter, putting new meters in, etc.
So it could be mutually beneficial to fiber and electric.
Absolutely. Now, I will say that the spirit of this was specifically around working on electric meters and meter bases, and oftentimes the ONT device or the optical terminal network for fiber is located, in some cases, just adjacent to the meter base. We refer to that equipment as electrical service equipment. So it's fair to say that we would, if the fiber ONT device is located near the meter base, we would get that space as well. However, this particular service regulation does not target the fiber ONT device specifically.
But it doesn't include it either.
It doesn't exclude it either. I'd probably need to consult with fiber operations to identify if they're having a problem with clearances.
Yeah. Because I'm also thinking about the, side of the customer's home.
Yes.
And how congested or non is that, or how spread out that is. And
sure.
Any exterior additions are generally not aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah, as we move closer to using more advanced metering technology, these policies that Kathy is talking about become very important because we may not be back at the premise to evaluate the clearances as often as we are today.
Yeah. So. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
You know what, Kathy, I think I have a question for Andrew.
Okay.
So maybe have him stay up if you would. On the load change, did you mention load changes?
Yes.
Okay. So, Andy, I think we talked about this before, new services application required for any load changes. But what are we doing to, how are we monitoring this? How are we picking up increased, significant load changes?
Sure. So specifically, what we have implemented during the moratorium on new HDL loads is a requirement that any non-residential service, whether they're HDL or not, every non-residential service is required to submit a new service application to us. So, for instance, if the Safeway grocery store sells to a new customer and Haggins comes into that building, they're required to provide a new service application for us. And that application asks the questions about what is your existing electrical utilization, what is your anticipated electrical utilization? So we're capturing a lot of that information through the new application.
What about the old ones that are existing and you see a spike in load? Is there a way to, are we picking those up?
Sure. We're doing the best that we can right now to try to identify those either through evaluating energy consumption monthly reads or just people in the field identifying with a change in load there. We're working towards that. We're also working towards trying to evaluate technology solutions that help us identify that change in load much sooner. And I think it's fair to say that in 2017 we'll be bringing forth some technology options to help us with
that. Yeah, because they're out there, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Okay. And then along with that change, we also have a reference to the upfront capital charge, and that is going to be stored in the fees and charges form. So it will be referenced, of course, in the rate schedule, but the actual calculation will be included in fees and charges. Okay. So next, we have some proposed changes to our line extension policy for water and wastewater services. And over time, we've made small adjustments to this policy to continue to align it with our electric line extension policy. And this is what one more step in that direction. So what staff is proposing is that rather than using a preset list of predetermined costs for each line extension, they would actually have the flexibility to estimate each of those projects individually and tailor the costs to those specific project needs, which is how the electric side of the house has worked at this point. And then this is a change that we're proposing to the regulations, and that's Regulation 65. We have our cross-connection control program, and that's in place to mitigate potential contamination that could occur between a customer's irrigation service and their drinking water service. And each year we are faced with knowing how to address the stragglers, those that don't get their tests and their inspections performed on their backflow assemblies in a timely fashion. So what we're proposing here is a method that would not only support our ability to meet our compliance requirements with the Department of Health, but would still provide the customers with options to ensure that that contamination could not occur. And so what we'll go with that is we'll continue with the courtesy reminders to the customers, along with a list of independent contractors that can perform that test. If the test is not completed by the deadline that is specified in those courtesy reminders, we'll have our own certified staff members perform the test for a fee, and then that fee would show up on their bill. That fee would then also be housed within fees and charges on a go-forward basis. And this is also a method that's supported by the Department of Health. They encourage water purveyors to move away from disconnection of service. That actually makes it quite cumbersome to even perform the necessary test. Can also pose sanitary situations and added costs.
Question on
backflow
protection, and I guess I'm a little bit surprised that we're just not doing it anyway as part of our overall billing structure. So when we install water to the residents, do we install the backflow protection as part of what we do, or is that requirement on the homeowner? That's question one. And then question two, would it or would it not be simpler to, have us do that as a standard part? I recognize there's a cost there.
Right.
I do understand that.
We're going to have Ron Slaybaugh answer that question for you.
Good morning, everyone. Ron Slaybaugh, Water and Wastewater Manager. We don't install them as a part of the regular water service. They're customer-owned devices. They aren't required for every connection.
Oh, okay.
It's only customers that have, on the residential side, the most common is an underground sprinkler system. So they need to have this device where in the event that we have a reduction in pressure, service pressure, for an unforeseen circumstance in our system, we don't get backflow into our water main. So they're customer-owned devices. We would prefer that the customers contract with the local certified testers to get those done. They can typically get that done at a lesser charge than what it would cost to have us do that work. But we've just seen over the last couple of years, there's a few stragglers, as Kathy mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And we get down towards the end, and they're not tested. We don't have all those devices on our tested annually. It's a compliance issue with State Department of Health. This is just giving customers another option and us another option for meeting our compliance requirements and addressing public health and safety.
Okay.
Thank you, Ron. Okay. And I did touch on this change already. This is going to be a change that is reflected only in our fees and charges. And it's an introduction of the application fee to go along with those water and wastewater line extensions. And then one of our final changes that we have proposed here is also going to be reflected in fees and charges, and that's a meter cost increase for the water services. The last time that we had made an adjustment to the fees for water meters was, I believe, back in 2014. And so staff performed their annual review of this, and there was a change in the material costs themselves. And so those changes are proposed here. So our next steps will to come back on December 5th with a resolution to adopt the proposed policy and regulation changes. As mentioned before, any of the changes within fees and charges that's already been previously delegated through 2007 resolution. And prior to the December 5th meeting, you'll, of course, receive the red lines so that you can see what those language changes would entail. Okay.
Any questions? Any questions from anybody in the audience? Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Next up, commissioners, is an issue that we've been working on, and I think we have a very interesting report to provide to you. Starting about 18 months ago, we concluded that there was something about the FERC licensing process that really didn't work very well, having to do with the fact that dollars that are spent by license applicants in advance of receiving the application don't get credit towards the term of the license. And FERC has decided that they can give anywhere from a 30 to 50 year license, and they provide that license on the basis of the amount of investment that's being made. That policy struck us as just bad public policy because it discourages license applicants from working with stakeholders in advance and coming to agreements that can be reflected in the license itself. But we've decided that we were going to put a lot of effort into this and have attempted to lead on this issue nationally. And I want to give Tracy Yount and Suzanne Grissel an opportunity to provide you an update on a couple of important things that happened just in the last 2 weeks.
Thank you, Steve. Tracy Yount, Director of External Affairs. And
Suzanne Grissel, Governmental Affairs Program Manager.
So as we thought about how to promote this change, we developed two pathways. One pathway was a legislative pathway of creating change for the FERC process, and the second was engaging FERC directly to promote change just at the policy level. They have the authority to do this without legislation. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the status of the legislative option, and then Suzanne is going to talk about something that happened just this last Thursday that was very interesting. So to date, we've enjoyed a great deal of support from utilities. We've engaged agencies on this credit for early action concept, and we've also reached out to NGOs who have been positive as well. So there's a great deal from coast to coast of support that Suzanne personally has reached out to folks and talk to people about, and others have engaged, but Suzanne has done a great deal of work getting that word out and getting support. So we now have this provision, credit for early action, in the energy legislation, but as you might imagine, things in Washington, D.C. are in a state of flux, and so it's hard to say what's going to happen over the next 30 to 60 days, but we expect that discussions will continue with this provision, and if the provision or the energy legislation does come through this lame duck session, we should know in the next, 30 to 60 days time frame, right? The specific date, we don't have that. But so we should know if this credit for early action provision that we've been working on is successful by the end of the year. So Suzanne now has something to talk about relative to something specific at FERC that happened on Thursday.
So the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission had their regular commission meeting on Thursday, and they had a hydropower item on their agenda. Now, FERC has a lot of their work is hydropower licenses, but we don't very often see kind of an industry-wide notice of proposed rulemaking or notice of inquiry come out. So it was kind of exciting. They had a couple of hydro items on the agenda, and one of them was a notice of inquiry on establishing the length of hydropower license terms. And they talked about how it was a good time to bring this issue up because they expect a lot of new hydropower licenses a surge of relicensings to come to them. And they actually put out this notice of inquiry for 60-day comment, looking at a potential 5 options on how they might adjust their current policy, which, again, Tracy had mentioned, is to in large part look at the level of investment going forward with your proposed license package. And so one of their options is basically to keep the current status quo. And one of their options was also to look at investments in the prior or in the current license. So unanticipated investments, new things that we might decide to do early. So that's basically what our proposal was. And then they had three other options. A couple of those also look promising. So it was an exciting day to see that what we had been kind of raising and working on was heard by FERC. And so we're enthusiastic about that. We should know, as Tracy was saying, by the end of the proposed comment period, whether the legislation has passed or not. So this would be another avenue if the legislation doesn't pass, that we would be able to work through the administrative process. If the legislation doesn't pass this year, conventional wisdom, for what it's worth this year, is that it could be up to 2 years before we see the hydro licensing package pass. So a lot of speculation, but at least a lot of good movement right now. So we're excited.
Timeline, kind of the 60-day comment period, and then
So the expectation would be, so this is just a notice of inquiry. FERC could decide to do nothing with it, but I already know that a lot of licensees are planning to comment. I guess the next step, if they decide to move forward, would most likely be a notice of proposed rulemaking, but they don't, you know, sometimes they do notice of inquiries and don't do anything. So we won't know for a while yet. It could be that they do a notice of proposed rulemaking fairly quickly. It could be that they wait a while. So maybe we would know in a 6 months to a year. It's a little uncertain.
Are there current FERC commissioner openings?
Yes. So right now, FERC is a 5-member commission, but there are only three members on the commission, and they're all Democrats. So with a Republican president coming in, we expect to see probably one commissioner step down and then three new commissioners be appointed. So again, there's a lot of uncertainty with the change in the commission. I view this as my view is that it's relatively non-controversial, kind of good governmental proposal. But again, it might take a little longer to work out with new members coming on the commission. I did read I listened to the presentation at FERC and, you know, took a transcript, and all three commissioners had good things to say about taking a look at this proposal. So hopeful that there'll be some institutional memory, you know, on this issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Anne.
Suzanne, does a notice of inquiry often lead to a notice of proposed rulemaking, or
Yes, that would be the next step.
But does that often happen, or is it just really unpredictable?
Well, yes, it happens. Definitely. I think that's pretty much the next step. Sometimes it dies and doesn't go anywhere, but we're almost glad in a way that it was a notice of inquiry, because it really gives industry and everyone else a chance to propose input before they just come out with a proposal and the notice of proposed rulemaking. So this is a really good opportunity for thoughts to get on paper before they decide their pathway forward. So I think this is a good sign that they've got their ears open and they're listening. So I'm hopeful that the next step would be, once they gather all the information from people who provide comments, that then they would select an option and put that out for their proposal of rulemaking.
Good work.
And no matter what the process, thank you.
Good job.
No matter what the process is, we will be engaging with FERC to participate, make sure that they're getting comments, make sure they know our perspective and hopefully others. And then we will learn more what that process looks like as we engage mm-hmm. FERC. As far as we can engage them through the comments.
So, assuming FERC moves forward with this, and let's say for the sake of argument that they codify these changes in FERC regulations, would the thought process lead you to continue to push for this in the energy bill from a legislative standpoint? So, I mean, what FERC, obviously, what they make a change at their level, they could once again change it some other way back.
Well, we'd have to see also what the final legislation looks like, and then there's subsequent rulemaking that would have to occur. So until it is solidified, it's unlikely that we would pull back from either path forward.
Yeah.
we would probably try to push these through clear to the end, because it will take some time, even if FERC does pursue the notice of rule or the notice of inquiry.
And I would add that among the five options is a no-action alternative by FERC, which we don't support.
Right.
And so what the legislation would do is make it clear that the no-action alternative is no longer viable.
Yeah, I guess my question was, what if FERC took the action we wanted before we had legislative action, how would that render our activity on the legislative?
It would still make sense to pursue, I think, the legislative.
That was my thought.
Because that's a policy, and a policy could be changed by
right.
future commission.
Right, right. Yeah. And then just a comment. We all got an email from Steve to share this good news with us on Thursday night. He couldn't wait. And I happened to share this with the PUD Association Board on Friday morning, and the immediate response from George Kahn was, "I see Suzanne Grissel's fingerprints all over this."
You're exactly right.
So outside of the Northwest, any indication of what other hydropower regions, their stance?
I mean, we have, I've been working on a list of supporters that includes utilities across the country, public power and investor-owned, Southern Company and consumers. Okay. Our Northwest Public Power utilities up here, Vista and Idaho Power, a lot of interest in this provision. So it's, some people can see direct benefit potentially because they've got relicensing coming up. Others have recently gone through relicensing, so it's not as critical for them at the moment. But there's, I think, consensus that looking at how licenses terms are established is a good idea right now.
And the feedback is the more they think about it, the more they realize how important it can be to them. Mm-hmm. So it's a neat idea initially. Then it's like, oh, this might really apply here or here. So like I said, this is across the country. Suzanne's been personally calling folks, talking to executives and talking to different associations to garner support on this. And it's a snowball effect.
Super.
You'll see this is in our APPA's resolution on hydropower licensing as well. So we try to get it in where we can.
You bet. And you do a good job at that.
Thanks. Well, I hope I'm enthusiastic about it. I hope it works out really well, and we'll be on top of it to make sure it goes as well as it can. Yeah. So.
It's been a long time since there's been any window of opportunity.
Yep.
Sure. Suzanne.
Yes.
Good job.
And Tracy.
Oh, no.
So I want to make sure that we also give credit as due here, that moving the legislation really put us in a position to be able to have this conversation with FERC. And Senator Cantwell was the prime sponsor in the Senate that got this provision included in the Senate version of the bill. Representative Kathy McMorris Rogers has been a proponent of it on the House side now as well. So we've been able to show that we have bipartisan support and that bicameral support. And that certainly helped us in terms of getting FERC's attention as well. We also had the opportunity to meet with both the staff and the commissioners, including the chairman, on this issue. And to their credit, we presented this issue and said, looks like a good public policy issue. And now they've taken this action in response. So we are grateful to all of them for taking the time to listen to us and actually think this through with us and help us get to where we are. Having said that, we still have two paths here. We're going to be pursuing both paths. Even if we get the legislation, there still is a rulemaking process that would be necessary for implementation anyway. So it does make it more clear in terms of what the option should be for FERC to consider. But we want both, actually. We want to be pursuing the legislation. We're hopeful that the Congress will actually address the comprehensive energy bill before the end of the year. That's the vehicle. It's mm-hmm. not going to happen without that. So we're kind of attached to that. And then we'll be actively engaging in the FERC process, including comments in this 60-day period with our set of priorities. We do like the concept of a 50-year license, just straight. It's a 50-year license. So there's like a couple of options here that we'll be supportive of.
An observation. Yesterday's meeting with Donald Trump was what some people call political speed dating. I mean, 21 people in and out of the parlor. But one of those 21 people was Kathy McMorris Rogers. And early entry into that conversation, I think, bodes well for the Northwest.
I think she's been very busy.
Yeah. Lately. So it was kind of heartening to see her as one of the people.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much. You're welcome. Great news.
Thank you.
So we put this on the agenda where we did because the board has indicated to us in the past that where we go with early action credit is a significant influence on where we might choose to go with some of the public power benefit proposals that operate inside the project boundary. Because any dollars that we spend in there today, we don't know whether we would get credit in our licenses. And we've got a Rock Island license coming up in 2027. So there's a direct relationship here between our ability to make progress on early action credit and the visitor center and splash pad proposals that have come forward as part of the public power benefit program. So we're going to provide you the update. We've done the pretty much completed the feasibility work that the board had authorized for us on those two projects. And there's a few things that I want to say about those and looking at these. First, it was our the challenge to the group that was working on this to not try to define specifically what we should be doing, but to create some options, the range of options from lower cost to higher cost. But not just that, a range of options in terms of the types of things that we might pursue. And so what you're about to see is a set of a variety of different options for both the splash pad and the visitor center. I think one thing is clear, and I'll just acknowledge it up front, particularly with respect to the visitor center, trying to do everything here vastly exceeds the budget that's available for public power benefit. So there's not even a suggestion here that we would try to do everything. The part of the issue here is just what types of things are we interested in. But even more important, given the direction that you've given to us, that we really shouldn't be moving forward on this until we better understand early action credit, our intention today is to give you an update on where we are in the feasibility studies. If you have any feedback for us, that would be useful. But we're intending to take these feasibility studies now and put them in cold storage. And by that, I mean we just keep them alive. But we will not be moving on them until we have a better understanding of what the outcome is going to be from the legislation and the FERC notice of inquiry about early action credit so that we're not committing dollars in advance of understanding whether they will count towards our license or not. So that's important setup for where we are today. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jeff Smith.
May I just make a comment about Steve's comments?
Yeah.
So I just want to make it clear that these options that Steve has mentioned are not options that came from the commissioners. They're not options that came specifically from the staff. They came out of our long strategic planning process, and they came from focus groups, from the community groups. So I just wanted to, I don't know if I'm reiterating something you said, Steve, but I just want to make that clear. These did not come from commissioners or staff, particularly in this room.
Thank you, Commissioner, and good morning, Commissioners. Jeff Smith, Managing Director of District Services. So you'll recall back on October 17th, we provided you with status reports on most of the 13 public power benefit projects. Today we're back with reports on the Rocky Reach visitor count and the splash pad feasibility studies, the electric economic analysis tool, and a wrap-up on the day-use pass pilot study. And in that packet that we handed out back in October, you now have pages and projects number 9 and 13, so you have a complete set. First, we'll hear from Debbie Gallagher and Casey Hall and Randy Cook of TCF Architects on the visitor count study. That was an effort that considered attractions and improvements to the Rocky Reach visitor facilities designed to increase visitations threefold.
Good morning, Commissioners. Casey Hall, Project Manager for the Study to Increase Visitor Count at Rocky Reach. Thanks, Jeff, for introducing us. With me today, I have Randy Cook with TCF Architecture, who was hired to complete the study for the district. As Stephen mentioned, our presentation will provide a high-level look at possible features and amenities for the Rocky Reach facility. Keep in mind that these are conceptual designs. Additional refinement of these features will be needed to provide a more accurate cost for the visitor count. projections and cost estimates for construction. Oh, there we go. Okay. So agenda today, we will highlight assessment report findings uncovered for the current visitor center, then move into reviewing approaches taken by TCF Architecture to forecast visitor counts for the visitor center, then review attraction examples and capital costs and follow up with any questions you might have. In development of these possible attractions, visitor center goals, we kept three goals in mind. First was, as indicated in the public power benefit proposal, was to increase the visitor count from threefold, from the 50,000 to 150,000 visitor count. The second was to not only increase that visitor count, but also enhance the educational experience of our customer owners and visitors to the facility. And third was to develop amenities that would maintain or enhance the security of Rocky Reach. As you well know, security of our major assets is paramount. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Randy Cook. He will run through the study, summary of the study.
Great. Commissioners, pleasure to be here this morning. We've been working with your staff for almost a year now on the hydro projects and all the future facilities work, but this project kind of grew out of that, and so we took it on. We brought on a team of specialists that are very experienced in museum projects and interactive centers and attractions of all kinds. We assembled a team that was able to go through this very high-level analysis to begin with. This slide just gives you kind of a quick background on the history of visitors to Rocky Reach, and you can see the 50,000 number is really the gate number, more like 30,000 coming through the visitor center itself. We have a report done by one of our team members that really established a baseline to understand how the visitor center and the whole Rocky Reach complex really is seen by your community, by the kind of the local region. These are just some snapshot bullets here of some of the findings from that. Just in the interest of time today, you can kind of peruse there, but probably the biggest takeaway is a facility that's really quite wonderful. The fact that it was built in the first place with the dam is great, that you have the kinds of things that you do, but it's very tired. It's been there a long time. While people love it, they love the fish viewing. It's seen many, many decades. And so you're kind of looking at the next generation, the next era of what could happen out at this facility. The biggest news is people really see Rocky Reach as a great thing. They're very proud of it out there. They're very proud that a lot of people have great memories going back a long way. But there's certainly a lot of room for opportunity, a lot of room for potential. This slide is just going to give you a very brief little set of visuals for some of the things that might happen. When you think about the fish viewing, think about broader apertures, floor-to-ceiling, acrylic windows where you're able to really see more fish or have more people available. The idea of interactive components and features within the museum, not just a place where there are old things to look at, but things that kids can really get in touch with, maker centers and those sorts of things. Lots of ideas can come out of those kinds of things. You have a lot of wonderful artifacts. The storyline is one of the things that really was talked about quite a bit, that there's so much more story to tell in terms of history and the geology of the area and hydro itself. So, again, a lot of potential there. Certainly the splash park, people think about just all the things that you can do outside the dam itself. We talked a little bit about how we could get people back and forth across from the Douglas side as well, maybe a water taxi of some kind. Lots of ideas. The image on the right is a project we did in Puyallup that's a big multi-use pavilion where there's farmers markets and things year-round. So we certainly want to be able to capture 12 months of the year if we're really going to have any hope of increasing the number of visitors out there. So really the main slide here today, again, just in the interest of time, is the boil down of some of the numbers we put together. And as Steve said, this is a very broad look. You're going to see some big ranges here. It's kind of an early shopping list, if you will. If you looked at the very bottom and you say, gee, really 170,000 to 210,000 visitors, that's if you were all in and you kind of went for it. That would be the full meal deal. But if you look down the list, you're going to see the key line items. And I think from this point going forward, considering where the priorities might be for the kinds of things that you really like to see happen out there while there's potential for all of these to happen. And even down at the bottom, we threw a little placeholder in there for something that might happen down at the Pybus Market, just in terms of a kiosk. But these numbers are generated by looking at the four seasons, saying we've got the, you know, each of the four seasons has potential for certain types of visitors. We tried to be a bit careful not to duplicate the number of visitors. So category A is really a visit type. So you would go there for any or all of these things. Meanwhile, the park itself might be a separate capture market. Now you might go to the park and then say, hey, there's a museum, let's go to that too. But we really tried to separate those out so we could, you know, try to be as conservative as we can here. There's no grand formula in this. If you were to track this and do everything and come back and ask me 10 years from now, you know, hey, how do we do? I would hope you'd see something like this. But you can certainly see that the types of ranges here are pretty significant, and they can be if these things are in place because people are looking for something to do, and the fact that it's free, that was one of the things I had a hard time convincing my team when they're used to putting numbers together for revenue projections. And in this case, we're saying, hey, we're just trying to bring people here. What do you do? How do you make it special? How do you make it interesting? And if you do these things, you have to keep them fresh as well. We all know that if we've been to an amusement place or we've been to a place where there's, you know, interactive things, you like that the next time you go that there's something new. And so there's also a need to keep these kinds of things fresh. And that has its own cost associated. And overall of this is really marketing. Right now there's kind of a baseline marketing that happens with brochures and, you know, information. There's certainly great information out in the school system. But for any of these things to happen to really be significant, there would have to be a pretty robust marketing effort that goes with it that would be different from how you market today in terms of, you know, just kind of a broad range. Marketing in Seattle, marketing kind of up and down, even the West Coast, trying to reach those to say, hey, there's something very special at Rocky Reach. And as our team put all this together, we said, you know, this thing really needs a name. You have the Gorge, for instance. You know, I said, how about we just call this the Reach? And everybody kind of liked that. We threw it out there. It's certainly not been vetted out, but we thought it was kind of a fun term and something that you could really market around. So those are the big numbers. There's a lot of thinking that's behind them, but again, it's a very high level, and I guess we'll just open up to questions at this point.
Just a comment. You used a phrase a while ago, the museum is, you know, old things to look at. My wife and I were touring the museum with two of our oldest grandchildren, and there's a photo in there of a ceremonial drum being presented to the commission. And our oldest grandson said to his sister, hey, look, Lloyd, Grandpa's so old, he's now in a museum. I would concur with your conclusion.
We didn't need to do a big report, did we?
Yeah, no. Just ask the 14-year-old, guess what happened.
Yeah. Any other questions, commissioners?
Was there a study done utilizing the visitors that come to Lincoln Rock to our camping facilities as potential guests? They're so close already. Many of those folks come from the region, not just the area, where we could somehow tap into those folks and offer them a tour of the museum. Was that part of the study?
Yeah, it was. We didn't go into any great depth, but there are some good counts on the number of visitors to Lincoln Rock Park every year, and that image I showed of the water taxi. If there was a way just to simply have a dock on both sides, we put a number to it. Give them something else to do. And again, if you've been there once or twice, you might not go back again, but if you, you know, there's always kind of a turnover. Right. Certainly that's a capture market. It's kind of small. It's not going to really throw the needle very far on that big visitor count, but it's something. Yeah.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Okay. Commissioners, let me just suggest the way we'd like to leave this one again is we're planning to take this and good work, but we're going to put it on the shelf for a while. If we were going to do anything out of this, it's, you know, it seems very unlikely that we would have the money to be able to do all of it. So if as you reflect on it, you have any thoughts for me about, one of these things seems like a good idea, so that when we get back to it, which will probably be at least a good 6 months from now, I would suspect, then we would have some sense of which out of these are the ones that are of greatest interest to you to pursue. So just leave that thought with you, and we can talk about it over the next couple of months.
Yeah. And just, Randy, I appreciate the good work, and I appreciate the enthusiasm. in your report. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. All right. So next is the splash pad feasibility study. That's a technical analysis of construction and annual operating costs along with location options. Court Hill has been the project lead. Court?
Good morning.
We don't have that one.
I don't think we have that one. In the packet?
It's in the big packet.
Oh, it's included.
It's not in color. It's not in color.
Is it this one?
Yeah.
I don't have it. Thank you.
Still don't have it. Thank you. There we go.
All right. Now I have.
Okay.
I'm feeling more connected.
Yeah.
Good morning. My name is Court Hill, and I'm project lead for the splash pad feasibility study. Here to provide an update on the types of water systems that were studied, the locations evaluated, site-specific designs, and the associated capital and operation and maintenance costs. A recirculated system, water system, is the most common type for a splash pad. This system uses a water storage vault, circulation pump, sanitation, and filtration system similar to a swimming pool system. The aim of this system is to conserve water. There's two very important notes about a recirculated pad. Number one, the Washington Administrative Code requires a restroom to be located within 100 feet of a recirculated system. And number two, a mechanical building is necessary to house and safeguard the water treatment equipment. A second type of water system is referred to as flow-through. In this system, the sprayed water comes straight from the water system. There is no reuse. The sprayed water is then collected and discharged to a wastewater system or other means of legal disposal. With this system, there is no requirement for a restroom to be within 100 feet, and there is no water treatment system, so no mechanical building is needed. The requirement for a restroom and need for a mechanical building results in the capital cost of a recirculated pad being as much as 2.5 times the capital cost of an equivalent size flow-through splash pad. However, the flow-through system comes with a higher environmental cost in terms of the volume of fresh water that has singular use before being discharged as wastewater. Over the course of a typical 100-day operating season, a 1,500-square-foot recirculated splash pad consumes 50,000 gallons of water, whereas a similarly sized flow-through system would consume 2.5 million gallons. To put that in perspective, 2.5 million gallons is equivalent to a typical shower running for 700 days straight. For all the parks studied, the source of water supply is the East Bank Aquifer. Water from the aquifer is coldest during the months of June, July, and August, when a splash pad would be in full use. For a flow-through system, this means the sprayed water would range from 50 to 60 degrees Fahrenheit, and for a recirculated system, that as the water is reused, it heats up, that would be a temperature range of about 65 to 75 degrees Fahrenheit. We've studied two different sizes of splash pads, 1,500 square foot and 3,000 square foot. Those dimensions represent the wet surface area. Designers commonly use a sizing factor of 14 square feet per bather, and this would result in a maximum kid loading of 107 for a 1,500 square foot, and for a 3,000 square foot, 214. So for the 1,500 square foot, there would be approximately 7 types of spray features, For a 3,000 square foot, there would be approximately 15 spray features, twice as many.
Court, just again, please, 1,500 square foot is how many?
How many spray features?
Yeah, I don't know how many bathers.
For a 1,500, it'd be about 107 maximum, so that's peak capacity.
Okay, thank you.
A total of 7 parks were evaluated for siting of a splash pad. Riverfront, Walla Walla, Confluence, Rocky Reach, Lincoln Rock, and Hydro Park. 2 sites were identified within Walla Walla, 1 at each of the existing picnic shelters. A major effort of the study included conducting thorough evaluations of each park. Through the stakeholder engagement process, a total of 15 evaluation criteria were developed. Each criteria was then assigned a weighting on a scale of 0 to 50. Depending on the magnitude of the criteria's importance. As shown in the matrix, Walla Walla Park Shelter 1 was the highest rated at 430 points out of a total of 480. And that was followed by Walla Walla Park Shelter 2 and Confluence State Park.
Which shelters are considered 1 and 2?
So Shelter 2 is the one further to the south. There's kind of a turnaround or a roundabout, and then Shelter 1 is close to the existing playground. Okay. As heard previously, the Rocky Reach visitor count study considered a splash pad at that location. In this study, we developed a site plan and an estimate for a 3,000 square foot recirculated system and a 1,500 square foot flow through. For both sizes, a splash pad was sited adjacent to the existing playground. The cost to construct a 3,000 square foot recirculated system is estimated at $1.7 million. And the cost, this cost assumes the district could attain a variance from the WAC requirement of a restroom being within 100 feet. The way it's cited now, the splash pad is more than 100 feet from the existing restroom. The estimated cost for a 1,500 square foot flow through at Rocky Reach is just under $600,000. Constructing a flow through system at Rocky Reach is complicated due to the large amount of water that would be wasted and a lack of a suitable wastewater system to receive that water. Construction of a recirculated Confluence State Park. So the advantage of Confluence State Park is that a splash pad could be sited within 100 feet of an existing restroom, and that's near the swim beach or the boat launch. Construction of a recirculated 3,000 square foot splash pad is estimated to cost $1.62 million. Construction of a recirculated 1,500 square foot splash pad is estimated to cost $1.28 million at the same location. The disadvantage of the Confluence location is that a Discover Pass is currently required for ratepayers to use the park. But currently, ratepayers can attain a Discover Pass through the Public Power Benefit Program. So if a splash pad were built at Confluence, the Discover Pass benefit would likely become more essential.
Quick question on the cost numbers that we're seeing. Are these including maintenance and operation for a set time period going forward for the life of the plan?
These are just capital costs, so construction costs. I will talk about O&M costs in a little bit.
Okay.
So the next location is at Walla Walla Park Shelter 2, the shelter furthest to the south. This area has the advantage of also having an existing restroom, albeit it's a small restroom, and that restroom would need to be expanded. Construction for a 3,000 square foot recirculated at this site is $2.36 million. And for a 1,500 square foot recirculated, $1.82 million. The challenge with this location, or one of the challenges, is that there is no existing playground. And nearly all of the sites that we've looked at with splash pads have an existing playground because the children will go to the splash pad to cool off, and they run over to the dry playground to warm back up. So this is the top rated site, Walla Walla Shelter at Shelter 1. We went into a great deal of effort trying to figure out how to get a splash pad within 100 feet of that existing restroom. There's several complications with that, with trying to do that. The closer to the river would expose the splash pad to flooding in June. And if it's within 200 feet, it conflicts with the shoreline development rules. But perhaps the most difficult challenge with that site is that if the splash pad is on the east side of the Apple Capitol Loop Trail, it presents a pretty significant safety hazard with children running from the wet playground to the dry playground, crossing over the trail. So a 3,000 square foot, let me go back to the previous slide. So we ended up locating the splash pad just south of the existing restroom, or the existing playground, and just north of the existing shelter. And this is another drawing here showing the playground, a 3,000 square foot recirculated splash pad, the existing playground, the existing picnic shelter. And because it's recirculated, it would require a new restroom and mechanical building. And the cost for that is 2.18 for the 3,000 square foot. And for a 1,500 square foot, we studied both a recirculated and a flow through. The construction cost for recirculated, $1.9 million, and for a flow-through, just over $600,000. The flow-through option would not require the restroom or the mechanical building. So operation and maintenance costs. A few interesting observations worth mentioning. First is that the O&M costs for a flow-through, they're primarily comprised of the cost of the water and the cost of discharge to wastewater. The labor and material costs are practically negligible for the flow-through system. The cost to operate and maintain the water treatment equipment of a recirculated system is considerable, such as the monetary savings from the water reuse is not fully realized. The takeaway is that O&M costs for a recirculated and flow-through system are not significantly different at the current water rate structure. So this last slide is the 20-year net present cost. So it takes the construction cost and adds to that the 20-year O&M cost. So with that, I'll take any questions, if there are any.
Questions, commissioners?
Just trying to figure out how to formulate it. This organization has a significant commitment to the environment in a non-recirculated seems to somewhat violate that basic principle. And, you know, I think that would be somewhat of an inhibitor to our primary structure, our primary purpose. It'd be a little hard to justify that when we're so conscientious as an example of circulating fish pens. You know, versus, you know, so the previous flow-through pens, you know, so I think that's an inherent conflict that would have to resolve, absorb, or reject. But thank you for, you know, that's really good information. I appreciate it very much. There's nothing like having your conscience pricked, so.
Yeah, candidly, we were a bit surprised by the conclusion here. It turns out that it's cheaper to do the more wasteful thing.
Well, you know, and it's been that way for a long time. We have the examples of that in the forest and other places. And, you know, if we're going to maintain our standards that we have, I think we need to really look at that when, you know, if this project goes forward,
you know, I think that has to be a center focal point to be in touch with our values, or at least our expressed values and our actions to this point.
Any other questions or comments? Okay. Thank you, Court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up is Andrew Grissel. The electric economic analysis tool has been developed and will be used to assess the benefits and impacts on Chelan PUD of new businesses that locate in the county.
Let me just close up that last section. So those were the two projects, again, inside the project boundary. So our intention is to put those on the shelf for a while. This is different. This is the work on the economic impact model in which it's a tool for us to do further analysis with. And so we want to present it to you and then have a couple of comments at the end about how we would intend to use it.
Great.
Thank you. Andrew Grissel, Manager Energy Development Conservation here at the district. Reiterating, this will be a project overview, a review of the development of the economic impact tool. No actions required for your information only. So background, the development of the tool came out of the 2015 to 2019 strategic planning effort. During that time, the board directed staff to develop a tool to help assess the economic impacts of new types of loads coming into the county to better understand from both a county and a PUD's perspective what those impacts are. To help us with that, we are not the historically economic development has not been our core competency, so we tapped into some of the local experts with the city of Wenatchee, with the port of Chelan County, as well as with Chelan County itself. And I would like to note there's at least a couple in the room. Craig Larson from the port and Steve King are here. Appreciate them coming and appreciate their help. And then we also had numerous internal team members on staff, out of finance, out of legal, out of customer utilities, all the major areas that could and would be impacted by use of this. Project status, we contracted with a consulting firm called FCS Group. They're well known at least in the Pacific Northwest for doing this type of work and had done something similar down out of the Tri-Cities. And what they did is they developed a customizable and interactive tool. And so knowing that information and data, how good it is going in is, you know, tells you how good your outputs are coming out. We need to make sure that we can customize it and put in the appropriate type of information and projects and data in there. It uses specific data for each new opportunity. And total contract for that was $40,000. So the methodology was important. We wanted to use something that was seen as a standard in the industry that other entities that do this type of work would have used. And so the consulting firm used something called M-Plan, and this was the basis of the model. And what it does is, you can see there's in the graphic onto the one side, you take the direct impacts from the actual new opportunity that comes in, looking at number of employees, wages, production costs, and then there's coefficients for different types of industries and different types of areas, counties, different type of geographies. And it takes that information and then it extracts indirect impacts and induced impacts. Indirect impacts are going to be impacts from, you know, the company comes in and they need supplies. So if there's more economic activity downstream of that particular industry or that particular company, such as they need more widgets, and so they now go and buy those widgets at a company that's nearby. Then there's the induced impacts. Those are the impacts that actually flow through the economy from the household spending. And so if you have more people that are making more wages, their spending increases, their spending down line, you know, down to the local market, down to the local eatery, down. And then those people are then getting wages. And so it kind of rolls down. And so so it takes all that information. And then we wanted to use our specific rates and lost market opportunities. For that, it also breaks out construction impacts and permanent impacts, because there is a difference. You have your long-term permanent impacts, which are the ongoing wages, ongoing things, but then you have one-time construction peaks, which might be a benefit for a while, but then might shift away. So we wanted to be able to understand that. And we also use local tax rates and fees, so that where it's all very specific to our area. And so the model takes all this together, and then it provides us some outputs. And it provides us a variety of ways to value and view new industries and businesses. This sheet right here is a direct output of the model, and this is for illustrative purposes only. Some numbers were put in there. What we can do is, you see the flow through. It's got your economic impacts, which are associated most directly with the jobs that are provided by the company. You look at your construction impacts. Those are those one-time fees. And then you have your fiscal impacts, which in the model are all the sales. Chelan County information. It's got the city information, shared taxes, those sorts of things. And then it comes up with the total benefits. And it's got two columns. We looked at it from both just a simple sum as well as a 20-year NPV. And so then you got your two columns. And then you also, on your, so that's your benefits side. So on your cost side, you have, you know, local public O&M costs. So if you bring more people into the area, there's going to be more people using the facilities. There's going to be increased costs, and so you'll want to try to capture those. And then also the big one for us is our lost opportunity from our electric rates. And these are the difference right now in the model is the difference between, say, our retail rates and what we could get on the market. And so we look at those, and that's all brought in. And then it comes down to the bottom where it looks at some benefit costs. And down here, we've got a few different ways to look at it. You can look at the direct return of the dollar invested. You can look at the secondary return. You can look at the total. But then you can also look at, well, what if we're looking at it from a just an impact of the taxes. And so the ratio between new taxes accrued plus the against the rates and fees. And so it provides us really with just a variety of ways to look at different things. And it also allows us to do what-if scenarios, sensitivity analysis. You can put in, you know, you can put in different rates. You could put in, you know, different numbers of jobs. Say the company thought, you know, is telling us saying one thing. Well, we could put in and say, what if they're off plus or minus 20%? So we can have, you know, you can look at it from different perspectives like that. And so it's really provides the output, it provides the information, it provides us with a way to look at new opportunities, look at new companies coming in from a variety of perspectives, and allows us to do so with our own information, with our own modeling tools, rather than just relying on what's coming in. So that bodes the question, how might we use it? Well, we can use it for information purposes. We can use it to provide to some of the other economic development entities so that there's one model that we're using, and if they're out and they see something, they could potentially use it. And it's also to help us inform decisions, and it's an informational tool. So it helps us to inform, helps to provide, maybe identify cooperative actions. So if we are talking with someone and say, hey, is there, you know, if we did this, what would that look like? And we could add that, put that into the model and see. We could use it to design certain hurdle rates. You saw on the prior sheet there are benefit cost ratios. Maybe there's a certain hurdle that we see as beneficial. You know, maybe not a one-to-one, because then we're just giving $1 to get $1. Maybe there's something better that we should be looking at and looking towards. And finally, this is envisioned at looking at those loads greater than 5 average megawatts. We have, you know, as everyone knows, we have the rates up through that, and so this is looking at bigger, larger type loads to come in, and this is one of the tools that could be used for that. So our next steps, we have ideas on hurdle rates, we have ideas on certain other ways to use it, but we want to get back together with our economic development experts and start testing those and start looking at what we can do. That works together with, you know, how do we balance that the social good of our rates with potentially individual benefits of increasing private wages? You know, how do we look at that? What's the right way that we want to do that? And so that's an important discussion that we need to have. And then finally, we need to, and it's already in a process right now, but develop a business process for how do we use this. Somebody comes up with a proposal. Someone comes to us. You know, it's got to come in through a certain route. It needs to have internal review, potentially external review. We need to have a lot of data assurance, quality control, quality assessment on the data to make sure what we're using is the right information, the most current information, the most up-to-date information. We don't want to take this lightly. And so so that's in the process of being worked on right now. And so moving forward, the tool is built, it's developed. We're not in production mode. We've got some discussions to do with our local experts as well, and to develop a recommendation on how to use it into the future, as well as developing how do we actually use it from a process perspective to make sure that it's being used in the right manner and being used with the right data.
Just, I guess, a question, and maybe I missed it, maybe I didn't. Where do we calculate the social impact? And let me give you an example. You know, there's been a lot of consideration recently of waste management, offloading sealed compacted railroad cars in INEAT and trucking those to the landfill in Douglas County. Seems as if, though, that's shifting perhaps to the intermodal facility in Quincy, which makes it a Grant and Douglas concern. But if you just use that first example of offloading X number or, you know, mile-long trains daily or multiple mile-long trains daily, you know, and you go through the economic analysis of it, it may make sense. But it seems like most people who are responding to it are not responding to it on what economic benefits may be there, but more on the social implications, social impact. And so, you know, my concern is in doing analytics, is yes, the social impact is oftentimes the soft side of those numbers, mm-hmm. but where does the social impact fit into this analysis?
So this is the economic portion of that, and so when we look at projects internally, there's a whole decision criteria that we go through. One of those has a lot to do with social and stakeholder. So as the total project we're being looked at, this would be a piece of that, and then we would also need to have, through stakeholder engagement, through our normal processes, to bring that social component into the decision as well. And so this is the economic piece model mm-hmm. of that, and then we would need to be bringing through some of those other pieces. Is that? Or?
Yeah, I think that's a really great answer, and I want to say that's exactly the right question. This has been a really fascinating exercise for me to learn how these models actually work. I had never really dove in before, and Andrew's been great in terms of helping us to understand the inputs and the outputs for this. And I think number one takeaway I would offer for you is these tools are very helpful. They will illuminate some things that we don't normally think about, because we normally just look at the impact on PUD ratepayers, and this is a broader perspective, thinking about our mission statement about how do we enhance the quality of life in the county and what are the impact across the county. But having said that, it misses some really important things. The second point up there on Andrew's last slide was the one about, well, you would be shifting dollars in effect, and there are equity impacts associated with that. Sure. And this tool does not address equity impacts. The point that you raise about social impacts is not included in this analysis. Yeah. So this tool will not provide the answer.
Yeah.
It will provide some useful information for the board to consider in its decision-making process.
And my question is in no way intended to demean you know, what we have in front of us, because I think this is going to be a very, very valuable tool. I guess I'm looking at, you know, what we just talked about is in addition to.
Absolutely.
You know, or as well as.
Mm-hmm. I think it goes right along with many of the decisions we make, that there's a financial component. We want to make sure we understand those, but there's also the social, there's environmental issues. There's all sorts of things that we want to bring into that decision-making process that this is to help us with some things that we don't normally do, we don't normally look at. And we've been building up competency, but we're going to need to continue working with folks that have that as a core competency in these specific issues, in these specific ideas. But yeah, you're exactly right. We need to look at that whole picture.
Yeah. But nice tool. I appreciate the effort. Great.
Any other questions or comments from the board? Okay. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
Good job.
Thank you.
Very much.
Thank you.
Our final report is provided by Ray Height. He's got a summary on the day use parking pass pilot program, which you recall began in mid-July of 2015. And he also has information on a tentative agreement with state parks regarding the fee structure moving forward.
Good morning. As Jeff said, Ray Height, parks manager here at the PUD. So kind of a little bit of history with the parking pass program that we started in July 15. Over the course of the last, I guess it's a little less than 18 months, that's how long the pilot program was for, we've distributed 2,400 passes, a little over that. 842 of those passes were distributed this year. and we quit distributing passes on September 30th. We call that the end date for it. A little history about, there was always a concern about price for them. In order to get the project off the ground and started when we wanted to get going, we chose to go with the $30 value that the state parks charges for their Discover Pass. It would have been a, kind of a non-starter if we hadn't gone that way. And the reason we did that is they had some concerns along the lines of playing with that value. They were concerned that it could have, you know, set a precedence across the state for other entities wanting to come in and do similar projects or stuff with them. And they didn't really know how many passes we were going to issue, which could have had an impact on their O&M in the parks. So as part of the pilot study, we stayed in contact and are staying in contact with state parks. As a matter of fact, we have a meeting with them this afternoon, a phone meeting to talk about the future agreement we're working on. So the good news is it had very little impact on the parks. They didn't really see a lot of, you know, excessive use or anything in the park. They were happy with the program. We conducted a survey as part of this. Part of the criteria for getting your pass was that you agreed to answer some survey questions. So out of the people we reached out to, we had 587 people return responses, just high level. 71% of the people that received the pass from us said they did not have a Discover Pass. 25% of those people said they probably would get one in the next go-around so they could visit other state parks. Of the three state parks that are operated, our parks that are operated by state parks, Lincoln Rock was actually the most visited with the pass, just from this survey anyway. Wenatchee Confluence was second. 81% of the people that got a pass said the overall experience with the pass was great. 15% said it was good. We only had a really small percentage that didn't really enjoy it. And we also asked them how they heard about this program so we can market it going forward. Most people got it from our postcard we sent out in the mail. Next level would have been newspaper, then email, then from our website, and following with radio ads. So now I'd like to talk a little bit about what we're discussing for 2017. We'd like to run this program on the calendar year to stay more in alignment with state parks. Theirs is rolling. Ours would be from January to December. It just makes it easier for our accounting. We want to, like I said, gauge how we're going to do our public outreach. We'd like to hit every ratepayer, electrical customer, and then identify the areas we're having low participation and target those areas to see if we can get more passes out there. As Jeff was saying, we are currently working with state parks. I said we have a phone call with them this afternoon on a new agreement. Sounds really good. I'll share with you some of the highlights of that. Hopefully, we're trying to have something in place so we can start letting people pre-register for these passes again in December so we can distribute them right as soon as we can in January. So the highlights of this new agreement, we're looking at doing a two-tiered approach as far as rates that we would pay to state parks. So for the first 2,500 passes, we have tentative agreement that we would be paying them $10 for those. And like I said, for the last 14 months or so, we've issued 2,400 passes altogether. So if we stay around those numbers, that $10 a pass looks really good. So for passes from 2501 on up to as many as we would distribute, they would go back to the $30. Again, they think that 2,500 number might be a tipping point for, you know, activity in the park. It could affect their operations. So to give an example, better get my cheat sheet out. If we distributed 3,500 passes, where it would be $55,000 to get to that level, the average price of the pass would still be under $16. And if we distributed all the way to 4,000 passes, the average price for the pass would be $1,750. So it's still a significant savings over just the $30. So that's my wrap up. Any questions?
Yeah. We distributed 2,500 passes or in that neighborhood this past year.
Correct.
Do we have any idea how many Chelan County residents visited the state parks and didn't use our pass?
We don't. State parks, they might have numbers. At least they know what has been sold for their Discover Pass within the county. But they don't really track to where the when they see the pass in the park, they don't really know where it came from.
It just was an interesting question that emerged in my mind. Have we maybe established pretty clearly what percentage of our residents use those parks?
So that would be an opportunity for survey. As we go forward with the next year of this, we will be surveying again.
Okay. Super. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions, commissioners?
Nope.
Thank you. That's our report.
Thank you. All very right. much.
Thank you.
So I'm going to just assume that we're proceeding as described here. Number one, that I know you had expressed concern in the past about the $30, so we think that that's being addressed mm-hmm. here. And with respect to the visitor center and the splash pad, that we'll be putting those on the shelf for a while and just want to confirm that you're comfortable with that approach. Okay. Yep. There's a lot of nodding of the head, so we're yep. going to keep going yep. then.
And, Steve, I'd just like to tell you that I appreciate the feasibility study that's been done and the cost analysis along with O&M, it's been a wonderful exercise that has brought great value to at least this commissioner. And so I also appreciate the fact that we're going to put it into cold storage for a while. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Okay, next up we want to do an update for you on the fiber build for 2017. Each year we come back and we say, what are our priorities for where we'll go with fiber expansion? And we've been trying to better integrate that between fiber and distribution because we now understand a lot better the connection to our pole attachment program. So both Mike Coleman and John Stoll will be presenting on this topic.
Good morning, Commissioners. Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecom.
John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities.
So why are we here today? Three things to update you on the 2016 expansion. Kind of go back through the decision to focus on reliability for the electrical system as well as the broadband network, the impact of that decision, and the ongoing collaboration between fiber and electrical distribution. We're also going to review the 2016 accomplishments and talk about the proposed expansion areas for 2017. I always like to start with where the rubber meets the road. None of this happens by magic. The crews, the people behind the crews, the engineering teams put in a lot of work to do this and do it very, very well. This first picture is hanging some aerial fiber in the Manson area, which is one of the areas we worked in 2016. The second picture is putting a fiber rack up on a pole in the Cashmere area. I happen to like this picture because it demonstrates several things, and one of them is the importance of us building in the safety and reliability by complying to the National Electrical Safety Code standards as we achieve the expansion.
There's a lot of wires on that pole.
There's a lot of wires on that pole. That's exactly right.
I like the previous picture. So, yeah, Mike's touched on this already, but there's been a strong effort of collaboration over this past year that's involved folks like Chad Rissman and Tim Pettit and Bob Shane and Mike's folks to really take a hard look at it as how we move forward with the build-out on the electric side and getting what we call make-ready work so we have our poles engineered and enough safety zone space accounted for so it makes for a safe and reliable installation as we move forward. So quite a bit of work was done around that, but subsequently it also caused us to probably slow down the fiber build-out as well. But it's been very successful. A lot of work on the engineering side was done this year, for example, around the Cashmere area and Mission Creek and Yaxham Canyon. That's been a focus up in Manson, the Washington Street area as well. So to that point, all that work that's gone into it, we are actually now getting ready to, at some point, put a bid out there for a contract crew because this is also pushing on our resources as well as we add line work. You know, we've been fortunate that our crews have covered a lot of this construction activity, but because we're adding more to the mix, it makes sense to put some of this work out for bid. So we plan on doing that and getting preparation for next year's construction season to get onto those areas.
We have some bid work going on now, correct?
I'm sorry?
We have some bid crews working right now.
On the electric side, most of our bid work has to do with more like excavation type activities.
Right. But
fiber, do we have any?
Fiber's being performed by internal crews at this
stage. Only.
We would occasionally, like John, have to call in a contractor for a particular item, such as excavation or something of that nature.
Okay.
Correct.
All right. Thanks.
So as a result of all of that make-ready work, as you're already aware, we did defer the Yaxham Canyon and Mission Creek Canyon areas in 2016 out to 2017, prioritized them for 2017. As a result of moving those areas out, we did move the Blue Star and Olive Way in Cashmere into the construction program this year. That's the famous or infamous donut hole, as coined by Commissioner Smith. That was and is still being performed in 2016. So where we are today in 2016, as of Friday, November the 18th, we've passed 578 premises. We have 36 connections completed. They're taking service. We have 31 pending orders. And so that leads me to talk briefly about the metric that we chose, which is premises passed. We deliberately chose that particular metric because it's the most meaningful to the customer owners. We could take a percentage of construction complete, but that's meaningless unless they can actually place an order with a service provider and get their service. So by saying that the premises is passed, it really means that we have the distribution up, it has light going through it, and the customer can place an order with a service provider, and we'll go back and construct their drop at that time to actually give them service. When I look at the number of orders, the pending orders, and the connections we have already made, those actually are quite realistic, even though they look low. Because of the delay in the start, we didn't actually have anything lit up until the July-August time frame. At the end of the third quarter, when we reported to you, we had 238 premises passed. So between the end of October and the 18th of November, we finished construction and we let up quite a bit of additional fiber. That also demonstrates that the areas, as we build them, vary considerably. We have sometimes a lengthy construction period for a relatively modest number of premises passed. Other areas are much easier, and we have a shorter construction period, and we gain quite a few premises passed very, very quickly. Our year-end expectations for 2016 is that we're going to pass 750 premises. That's compared to our original target of 1,038 premises. I have to say that the efforts by both my team and John's team, they really wanted to hit the original target, even with the late start that we got. But with the significant make-ready work and all of the resource loading that had to take place behind the scenes, we're expecting that we will end the year at about 750 premises. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Micah, just a question. Our normal take rate is in the low 40 percentile?
Overall, we're currently right at 45%.
45%, yes. Okay. And so these right now, the 578 premises, about 12%. How long does it usually take to go from that, as an example, the immediate, let's say, 12% to the 45, or is that like asking how long is a piece of string?
I'm actually quite happy that you asked that question.
Well, we had that worked out.
Industry. Industry standards say it takes about 2 years to get up to your optimal take rate. We would like to shorten that. We did deliberately say that for the first 2 years, when the construction order is open, we will build the drop to the customer's premise at our cost. After that, they fall into the line extension policy. So that mm-hmm. offers them an incentive to be on within that 2 years.
Okay.
I think the other thing that we've learned, and we've learned this from other districts, particularly Grant County, the district itself has to get very, very aggressive in our outreach program and in our marketing program to affect that take rate. We have as much impact on that as the service providers do. So that's also in progress for us to up our outreach, up our marketing efforts in a direct attempt to influence the take rate and to get the take rate quicker.
Okay. Thank you.
We are optimizing our construction activities as we move into fall and winter. That's always an issue in this part of the country. What's next? For 2017, potential public power build fiber areas, we're again looking at Cashmere, Chelan, Leavenworth, Manson, and Sunny Slope. This would result in approximately 928 new premises next year. My boss has talked to me about, am I creating a hockey stick effect for the program? And I would tell you that no, in reality, there is a lot of variability from year to year with the build areas that we're approaching. And particularly with us collaborating with John's team, we pick the areas that we can handle with our resources, even considering contractors. Overall for the program, I have to average about 950 a year to achieve our target for this entire build out. So I have a little bit to make up from 2016. I'm also optimistic simply because I've looked at the areas and looked at some of the engineering. We do have some areas that we'll be able to move a little quicker and pick up a larger number of premises passed in those particular years. So we're optimistic and confident that the overall program is on schedule. Between my team and John's team, they've already performed the engineering design and resource planning for these areas in 2017, and that is what is included in the district budget, which you will hear about later today. I think the other thing that we wanted to convey is that we utilize the same criteria that we gave to you back at the start of the program and what we used in 2016. We're still in that crawl before you walk, walk before you run stage, both resources and processes. So we stuck with this criteria, which is adjacent to existing areas, no major constructions, in other words, no new nodes on the fiber side right now. We're still preferring overhead distribution and minimal new fiber distribution. We added this last one during 2016 when we made the decision to achieve NESC compliance and improve both systems at the same time, and that is that we want to coordinate with the electrical distribution priorities as we perform the selection and the build-out.
A question, Mike. Our normal or average customers per mile
mm-hmm.
And the new construction that we're doing, not necessarily new construction, but the passing of new premises, is that ratio remaining about the same? Is it a large number per mile, less customers per mile? And it's just for information only, certainly not for criticism.
It's remaining relatively the same,
okay,
which is a little bit different than what you would expect. In the more rural areas, it, of course, is a much lower number, in some cases slightly lower, in other cases significantly lower. But you also go back to the fact that we not only had the donut hole in Cashmere, we have donut holes everywhere in the existing network. If you remember, the last area that I had on that list for 2017 is Sunny Slope.
Mm-hmm.
So an area like Sunny Slope is going to have a fairly high customer density, premises density per mile. Many of the infill areas will meet that, and that in an overall sense will hold the number about the same for the system.
Yeah, so it's a combination of infill and extension.
And extension, correct.
Okay. Thank you. That helps because it you kind of get that question every now and then. Formatted a little bit differently.
Right.
But it's good to have the information. Thank you.
It is, and it's also helpful for me to look to other districts, other telecom companies, and look at their density. Ours is certainly not the same as Grant County's, and it's not even the same as Douglas County's. Right. So I always hesitate to put a map up here because there's no way I can show enough detail. If you look at this Chelan County map, the dark green areas represent those areas for 2017. In addition to the dark green, if you were able to see it, on the south side of Chelan, there's some cross-hatching, and then there's also some cross-hatching in the Sunny Slope area, which represent those two infill areas for 2017. We always have our unknowns. For both the electrical side and the fiber side, they are generally the same as they always are. We have no idea what's going to happen with a major winter storm. We don't know if we're going to have major fires or any other emergent work priorities that could affect us. And as always, we're reaching out to get people to the website, to direct them to the service providers, to put in their request to be connected to the system just as soon as possible.
So, additional questions for Mike? Comments? Just have one brief comment. You know, always wanting to give credit where credit is due. I'm not the one that coined the donut hole term. I think Mike was probably at the same meeting I was when a really good friend of mine who lives in the middle of the donut hole coined that term. And so I adopted it readily. I will admit that.
Yes, and we all remember.
So thank you.
Certainly.
If I could just add, the way I think about this program is we're about a quarter behind where we would have liked to have been at the start of the year, but we really needed to do that to go to our values on safety and operational excellence. We really needed to better understand these changes to the National Electric Safety Code, and we needed to better understand the integration with the electric distribution system work to make sure that we weren't going to put wires up to meet a target and then find out we had to come back and spend more money later to fix it. So I think the strong planning will put us in a better position for making sure that we carry out this program consistent with the original objectives of how much we were going to accomplish at what cost.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that one of our new linemen hires explicitly talked about the safety record as one of the motivations for applying and being accepted here. And I think that priority is what we should do every day. But also it has additional benefits in terms, I think, of attracting and maintaining quality employees. So it's a nice combination. It all fits well together. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You wouldn't have a five-minute manager item, would you?
Well, I don't have a five-minute manager item, but I did think that I could cover a couple of the board action items from last meeting just to move that through. Okay. So we had a couple. First one was you may recall that we were talking about the White Pine relocation, and one of the questions was the timing there and why we felt a need to try to move forward quickly. And so we did go back and confirm that the grant funding, that is the reimbursement for that, there are some deadlines associated with that that causes us to believe that we really want to try to be finished by June of next year. And so that was the driver for trying to keep that project moving forward because the full reimbursement is our expectation for the project, and we don't want to undercut our likelihood of being successful at that. The second one was we had a commitment to get you some information regarding the volatility of prices, and I have to admit that I'm going to take accountability for holding that one up. I miscommunication with Greg, he got the information immediately, and it didn't get to you until this morning, but you do have that by email as this morning. So I know, Commissioner Smith, that was a question that you had asked. So those were our two follow-up items from the last meeting.
Okay. Probably about lunchtime then. Why don't we recess and reconvene at 1 o'clock?
All right.
Every day. Good afternoon. I'd like to call the afternoon session of the November 21, 2016 regular commission meeting to order. We met this morning in study session, and we're meeting this afternoon in business session. And our first item of business for the business session is a public hearing regarding the 2017 preliminary budget presentation.
Thank you, Commissioner. My name is Mark O'Brien, Finance Director over Strategic Financial Planning, and I'm here today to continue the public hearing that was initiated on November 7th, reconvening today, and that is also be planned to be reconvened on December 5th, at which time we would look to adopt the 2017 budget for the district. I would also note that this process is in compliance with Resolution 07-13147 associated with the annual budget process for the district. We'll identify the agenda for today. It should be relatively brief. We will give you a quick review of the timeline. We will identify and reiterate the key strategies driving the 2017 budget and the five-year business plan. Look at a few recent adjustments as we fine-tune the budget numbers for 2017. Look at the overall financial results of that budget and then identify next steps. No board action is required today. Again, as stated before, we will be coming back on December 5th for adoption of the resolution of the 2017 budget. Quick overview, timeline dates back to early in the year, which finalized with the business plans being approved and presented to the board in September. We have been back and to the board over several meetings in October and November discussing the details of the 2017 budget, and moving forward, we'll be back on the 5th, as previously stated. I just want to continue to reiterate the key strategies that are driving the 2017 budget. First and foremost, no electric rate increases planned. This is the fifth straight year. The district is focused on investing in the core assets. We have a $95 million capital investment program planned for 2017. We're also planning to continue the debt reduction program with an additional $52 million in 2017. Also, continue on pup car benefit, in particular, continuing the expansion of the fiber program. And all of these things are being driven by the strong financial results, which we are forecasting in the budget to be about $86 million in 2017. So that's a quick overview.
Mark, I think it's probably good to point out that $95 million in capital investment will be taken out of our own assets, and we won't borrow even to do the capital investment.
A good clarification. Yeah, due to the strong bottom line results the last few years, as well as next year and over the next several years, the district continues to pay all capital out of pocket at the same time as reducing the outstanding debt balances. And just to give everyone a sense of what's driving the ability for the district to do this, I would note that 80% of our overall revenues are coming from outside the district or outside the county. These are through secondary surplus sales, these either through the long-term power contracts or through other market agreements like our slice contracts. I would note that the district continues to adjust for lowering market conditions that we foresee over the next 4 or 5 years and beyond. I would also note that we continue to see our revenues exceed expenditures or operating costs through 2021, so that over that five-year planning period. And again, district priorities to reinvest in assets, people, continuing debt reduction, and continue on with the public power benefit program. Again, the overall theme there is to continue to strategically invest in our assets, lower debts, maintain strong cash reserves, which will provide that resiliency in the event of downward pressure on market conditions in the future.
And Mark, if I could underscore, I think one of the key things that we are looking for confirmation from the board on at the next meeting when we will be presenting the budget for final approval is that we're setting priorities within our priorities as listed on the screen there, that the highest priority will be investing in assets and people, and the second will be reducing debt balance, and the third will be the public power benefit program, which is a refinement of the strategic plan.
I would note that since we presented 2 weeks ago, there have been limited changes to the planned expenditures in the 2017 budget. This slide highlights those changes. We have revised up some revenue expectations. These are associated with our cost-based contracts activity. Those were up about $2 million in 2017. Operating expenditures remain consistent. Non-operating activity, interest earnings, interest expense, that remains consistent. And I would also note that overall is driving the bottom line up slightly. I would note that, also note that we continue to update the market-based wholesale revenues, and we will do one more update probably later this week in preparation for the final budget. At this point in time, it looks like those revenues may come down a few hundred thousand. Again, a small fraction of a percent adjustment, but we expect those to remain consistent going into the December 5th presentation. We've also adjusted down capital slightly. Again, that's the $95 million investment. We've reduced it about $2 million. So again, just a couple percent change. And that was really just in rescheduling some major work out at Rock Island and deferring out some of those schedules beyond 17.
Mark, I was going to facetiously ask that if you came up with $2 million in the last 2 weeks, can we expect that to the end of the year?
Most likely. overall, everything remains relatively consistent. These are small fractions of percent changes. I did want to call them out in this presentation. Looking at the summarized results for the district, we're looking and comparing back to the 2016 budget. Revenues, again, remain consistent. Operating expenses are actually down slightly. This is, again, primarily driven by the additional expenditures we had in 16 were related to the large units at Rocky Reach. and again, non-operating activity continues to go down as we continue to the debt reduction program, thus reducing the interest expense for the district. Overall, forecasted bottom-line results are in alignment with this year's forecast, which is higher than the initial budget, which was at about $76 million, and we're currently looking at about $86 million bottom line for 2017. I did include a summary on the capital expenditures for the various business segments of the district. I would note that all of these remain materially the same except for Rock Island, which again has been revised down slightly related to some scheduling of the units. In particular, B6 and B7 were some dollars removed between those projects, just reducing that just under $2 million. Overall, the total capital plan is about $95 million. For 2017, and that is up from this year's planned expenditures that were just under $80 million. This next slide just identifies total expenditures for the district, again, driven by strong bottom line results. we are covering all of these expenditures through cash reserves or future earnings. Total operating expenditures, including capital, as you can see here, is about $288 million. That's up slightly from last year, primarily driven by the additional capital investments. And that number is down slightly compared to the November 7th presentation. And including debt reduction of a little over $52 million, total expenditures about $340 million in 2017. Again, that's again slightly down compared to the prior presentation on the 7th. We'd also like to reiterate the district continues to meet all of the targeted financial policies at the combined district level as well as the individual business line segments. Again, this is just reiterating those targeted financial policies for 2017. And that'll take me to my conclusion, which is really just to re-identify the strategic focus for the district continues to look at increasing value for our customer owners. looking over the next 5 years, substantial bottom line results are still expected. They are declining, but remain healthy over the five-year horizon. Again, the district continues to focus on decreasing risk by investing in our assets, compliance, and other plan investments. At the same time, continuing debt reduction to put the district in a good position financially. We are looking to reduce debt overall $280 million over the next 5 years, which will get us down to roughly $300 million, where once we were over $1 billion, so significant reduction over that planned window. And also noting that the last general rate increase that we had passed was about 5 years ago, and we currently do not have any placeholders in our five-year plan for additional rate increases at this time. So that's just a quick overview of the updates to the 2017 budget, and I would open up for any questions.
Any questions from fellow commissioners?
I have one. Page 11. So the targeted liquidity is greater than $178 million, and it says that's up from $175 million. That's the target. But our financial liquidity today sits at about $360 million. Correct?
Correct. Yeah. We're well in excess of the targeted levels, which are really the min levels that we want to maintain. And so over the five-year horizon, we maintain the min levels or above. We have a hard minimum threshold of $175 million, or we have a calculated amount, which in this case in 17 is slightly higher than that due to some additional requirements. Part of that calculation includes looking at future capital plans as well as future debt reduction plans. And it incorporates cash reserves to complete those programs. And so it is slightly higher. Historically, the minimum level of 175 is usually what we target. And this is just slightly higher.
And we are sitting at about $350 million,
$360. The current liquidity position is, just look it up real quick.
Four,
Jack. And it varies. This is the forecast for 2016 will be at about $370 million. And that does drop down to about $350 million in 17 by year end. Again, driven by a lot of capital, additional debt reduction. So we are using some existing reserves as well as the earnings that we're planning to have in 2017.
Any questions from Mark, from anybody? Member of the audience. Thank you. So we'll see you here again in 2 weeks.
Yeah, I'll just note that's really the remaining step. Come back if you have any questions in the interim, forward those on to me. Otherwise, we'll be back on December 5th for approval from the board. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Long process.
Continue.
For you.
Yeah, for you. Thank you.
So,
chairs. Do we have any more chairs?
You want to talk on that or?
No.
Okay.
Oh, you're
it's a financial jailbreak right now. Budget's over. They're out of here.
Okay.
That wasn't a good thing to combine financial and jailbreak at the same time.
So, commissioners, next item on our agenda is the consent agenda. And if you'll recall, this morning we moved items, resolutions 13, 14, 16, and 17 to the consent agenda. So I would entertain a motion to approve the consent agenda, including those four resolutions.
We're going to kill each other with kindness. I move to accept the consent agenda as presented with the amendments as presented.
Been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda with the addition of the four resolutions. Any discussion? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried.
Okay.
Item 11?
Yes.
Okay. So at this time, we're on the regular agenda, and the first item is resolution number 11.
This is the resolution authorizing the general manager to enter into an agreement to purchase 26.45-acre parcel of land along the Columbia River in Douglas County from the Washington State Department of Transportation. Jeff Smith is going to introduce this issue.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Jeff Smith, Managing Director of District Services. And thank you to Greg for helping to get our graphic up there. This is a significant moment in the history of Chelan County PUD and our customer owners. The moment involves 26 acres, as Steve indicated, of undeveloped property downriver from the Otobashan Bridge on the Douglas County side of the Columbia River, extending from the Apple Capitol Loop Trail to the shoreline. It's a truly unique parcel of land that has great amount of community value. For that reason, there have been ongoing efforts in recent years to retain the property in public ownership. Now, your action today, and this is an action item with the resolution, will make that happen as Chelan PUD staff, in partnership with the Chelan Douglas Land Trust, is proposing a plan to maintain public ownership of the land for generations to come. Before we do that, it is important to acknowledge some individuals who have played major roles in making this day possible. First of all, retiring State Senator Linda Evans Parlett. She was a key player in building support from the state capitol and rallying the troops here at home throughout the years we've been working on this. Bob Parlett, co-chairman of the Complete the Loop Coalition with Dr. Gordon Congdon, who had a long-term vision of the waterfront area. Dave Biersbach, he's the Assistant Regional Administrator for the Washington State Department of Transportation, and he's here. We also call him WashDOT. He's with Frank Splendoria, who's in charge of properties with the regional office. They worked with their boss, Regional Administrator Dan Sarles, to carefully balance the needs of their state agency with that of the community they live in. Bob Boogert, immediate past executive director of the Land Trust, who quietly and diplomatically pursued public ownership of the site. And someone that I'm fairly certain you haven't met previously, but an individual who is playing a key role in this transaction. His name is Cliff Bates, a resident now of the Quincy area, but who for 25 years was a Chelan PUD employee, a system operator and chief operator at Rock Island and Rocky Reach Dams before he retired in 2002. Cliff chaired the Save the Riverfront Committee during the 1980s and 1990s, leading a spirited campaign to preserve the riverfront for recreational uses instead of a highway. Taking that commitment another step, Cliff and his wife Mary, and they're both here and you'll meet them shortly, are now making it possible for the Land Trust to participate financially in this purchase. So here's the deal. The property has been declared surplus by WashDOT and offered to the PUD for its fair market value of $458,000. The PUD and Land Trust have agreed to share in that cost. The district has also agreed to pay up to $5,000 in closing costs. You are being asked today to authorize the purchase, which involves a down payment of $45,800 that's due on Friday of this week, and the balance of $412,200 within 60 days, plus the closing costs. The PUD will accept responsibility for long-term operations and maintenance, basically signage, litter control, and restrooms. As part of the agreement with the Land Trust, a conservation easement will be provided to the organization, ensuring public access for non-motorized recreation on the property and precluding substantial property development anytime in the future. The Land Trust will monitor compliance with the easement in exchange for a one-time payment from the district of between $17,000 and $22,000 that goes to the Land Trust Stewardship Fund. That's administered by the Community Foundation of North Central Washington. The Land Trust will also fund an on-site memorial that will recognize the work of the Save the Riverfront Committee. Now, portions of WashDOT's Otobashan Bridge property are currently within the Rock Island Hydro Project boundary. The district has committed to WashDOT that we will propose to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, that the project boundary be realigned close to the trail upstream and downstream of the bridge to allow full potential for economic development to occur above the trail. That involves about 11 acres of land north of the Otobashan Bridge and about 2.5 acres south of the bridge. And so that you know, conversations with FERC staff have been supportive of this approach. We are also working on a concept drawing for the area, and we'll schedule a meeting next spring to obtain input from the public. The concept, too, will require FERC approval. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or any comments from the audience.
Commissioners.
I guess, Jeff, maybe just a comment. My wife and I, with three young boys, moved here in 71.
in that particular piece of property. Became a visual representation, I suppose, maybe of my childhood, having grown up in a rural setting in Southern Oregon. And I thought at that time, if there was any way to preserve that piece of real estate for young boys and girls and people who enjoyed the outdoor, it is so unique. And so I don't pretend to have the legwork or the effort that many people in this room have invested in this, but it is an absolute pleasure to sit here today and be able to vote on the purchase of this piece of property. It's been a long time in coming, and it'll preserve it for our public in perpetuity, and that's a really meaningful thing.
Now, I do understand there's maybe some members of the public that would love to make some comments about this purchase at this time, and we would love to hear from you. If you give us your name and address for the microphone, and
well, thank you very much.
Point it at your mouth. Just point it right at your mouth.
I haven't been giving speeches here for the last 30 years, so I'm a little rusty. I thank you for the comment. I thought.
Hey, Jeff.
You might be interested in knowing. Let's put you up here this way.
That one's not working.
I thought you might be interested in knowing what we had as my contribution to this project. A long time ago, in 1968, there was a movie called 2001: A Space Odyssey. And in it, they have a monolith that they discovered. That hit me at the time the battle was far in the future, but it always struck me as something that had a real significance to it. So came up with this idea of using this monolith down there. It is black. It weighs 8 tons. Yes.
Wow.
How we're going to get it to where we're planning is something else. But it's 8 feet tall, 4.5 feet wide, and 2 feet thick. And then that sits on a 1 foot pedestal. I planned on having a time capsule underneath it. This would be a burial vault. And be a big enough size to put substantial amounts of things in it. It is all designed. I had an architect go over it. It is all designed to last 150 years. And I hope it would. I hope it would be updated at various times through there. At this location, I don't know. We found what appeared to be a perfect location for it on a top of a rock pinnacle. And whether we can put the time capsule underneath it is a question. But we'll give it a shot. And I think the public will be very, very pleased with what you've done. I know I am. It's been a long time coming. DOT has held on to this property for 60 years and pretty much kept the public off of it until Dr. Congdon got the trail in. So I won't take up any more of your time. I just thank you for your efforts, and hopefully you'll pass the resolution and make my life worthwhile.
I would love to make a comment that not only is... You say the public will be pleased with our action. I think the public is really pleased with your action, and we owe you a lot of thank you. Really big thank you. Thank you.
First time.
Yeah,
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Thank you for having me. I'm Bob Bugert. I'm the Partnerships Director for the Chelan Douglas Land Trust, and I am honored and delighted to introduce our new Executive Director, Kurt Soper, who just started earlier this this year. So we're delighted to have him. I would like to just also say that, you know, one of the great joys of working for our community nonprofit, the Chelan Douglas Land Trust, is that we have an opportunity to work with people that are truly selfless and have the community's best interests in mind. And I cannot think of a better example than Mary and Cliff Bates. And it's been an absolute joy to work with you too. So thank you for everything you've done. And I also want to thank the Chelan PUD for its partnerships in this. This is really brings out what's best about our community, is that opportunity for public-private partnerships. Bring your strengths and our strengths as a private organization to benefit the people in our community. And with that, I'd like to pass it over to our new Executive Director, Kurt Soper.
Thank you, Bob, members of the commission and staff and members of the audience. This being my first commission meeting, I'm not sure you always have a standing room only audience. I got to wonder if this project might have something to do with that. It is an absolute honor and delight for the Chelan Douglas Land Trust to be partnering with the PUD in this great project, because it is a gem. It's already been described, but what an asset for the community this is and will continue to be forever. So we're delighted to play our part. Jeff did an outstanding job of describing the role of the Land Trust, which really started with Cliff and Mary's generous donation and support. We will hold a conservation easement on the property and be there to provide some funding for the acquisition. And I hope this is the first of many more times I could sit up here and in partnership with the PUD. So thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Congdon.
Yeah, Kurt, may I ask you to describe the term conservation easement? My brother used to be affiliated with Chelan Douglas Land Trust, and I think I asked him three times. This is so counterintuitive. It's not really it's not really an easement. So could you explain that term for our folks?
Not like a utility easement, right. Right. Most people think of it as a utility easement where someone has the right to come in and put a sidewalk or a power line or something like that. But this is a conservation easement, which will take certain uses and rights of the property, in this case, the rights to build structures on the property or to do anything that would damage the conservation values of the property, and those will be held in an easement that will be held by the land trust. And our responsibility will be, in perpetuity, to be annually monitoring the property, making sure, essentially, that the PUD is doing the right thing and that the property is still conserved. So that's, in this case, this what this conservation easement basically has those kinds of terms.
Good explanation. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Any other public comment? Senator Parlett.
Thank you very much. Well, I would like to thank Jeff Smith, because Jeff, I believe it's at least 5 years ago, if my memory serves me right, that came into my office in Olympia to talk about this. I also would talk about it with Dan Sarles, but then I just kept my mouth shut. So now after 5 years, I'm so glad that this is all happening. And it's amazing, if you have a vision, how you can bring people together, no matter how long it takes. But a very special thank you to the Bates, because to have somebody who used to work for the PUD to be involved with this makes this really special. So, thanks.
Dave Birschbach, I'm the Assistant Region Administrator for Engineering with the DOT here in Wenatchee. And this effort has been part of quite an effort. We meet with Jeff and his staff regularly in some coordination meetings on a variety of issues that DOT interacts with the PUD on. And this has been a topic of discussion ongoing. And so DOT, in about a decade ago, did an environmental impact statement on looking at, we weren't going to be building on the other route, what else can we, where else will our traffic be going? And so a few years ago, as you've seen, the Eastmont extension was completed, and so that alleviated some of the traffic. And then recently, the legislature enacted the Connecting Washington legislation, which will provide some improvements to Sunset Highway in the 2020s timeframe, and Senator Parlett was integral in that and getting that project into the budget. So with that, the legislature has directed us to dispose of surplus properties, and disposing of those surplus properties would put money back into the gas tax fund to be used at DUT projects around the state and eliminate needs for other sources of funding. So with this, the DOT has been taking a look at it, and on this section, working with the PUD, being an adjacent landowner, being within the project boundary, everything came together and added up for surplusing this to the PUD. We appreciate the PUD stepping forward and working with the DOT on this to put this property into the community asset. DOT is happy this property is going in as an asset to the community. And just appreciate the collaborative work that your staff has done with our staff to make this process go as smoothly as possible. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner, that's it.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. I think it's significant that when the, on this side of the room, the first two rows are either dealing with a conservation project or a park, speak to all of the values. And it's a real pleasure today to be a commissioner.
If I could, I'd like just to say thank you to our partners. This has been a really smooth process, and very much appreciate the participation of WSDOT, the Land Trust, and the Bates family. I do want to call out Jeff Smith, if I could, for a second, because every organization needs a compass to what's important to the community, and Jeff plays that role within our group. Candidly, as a newcomer here, I'm not sure if I would have recognized how important this project was to us. He's the one who made it clear to me that we needed to spend time on this and make sure we got it done. And then he's the one who went and made it happen inside the PUD. So, Jeff, I really appreciate everything you've done.
Thank you. Thank you.
I want to round the applause for everybody.
So, fellow commissioners, I recognize that there are moments that when some resolutions are more equal than others. And I think this may be one of those moments. And Commissioner Congdon, did you had a request of me?
I did. I would be honored and thrilled to move approval of Resolution 11, authorizing the general manager to enter into an agreement to purchase a 26.45-acre parcel of land along the Columbia River in Douglas County from the Washington State Department of Transportation.
Second.
Been moved and seconded to approve Resolution 11. Is there any additional discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, very much.
Thank you.
Ready?
I think so. Commissioners, we're not going to try to top that one. But we do actually have another very important project that we're interested in talking about. So Resolution 12 is a resolution ratifying field work order, change orders number 1 through 9, authorizing final acceptance of work performed under bid number 13-01 with Hearst Construction, LLC in Wenatchee, Washington, and authorizing payment of retainage.
Good afternoon, Court Hill, project manager.
Casey Hall, project manager.
We would actually like to start with a video presentation that shows some of the before and after pictures of Eniat Park. As soon as we can get that queued up here.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank Hearst Construction for loaning that video presentation to us.
So project challenges come in many forms, such as budget constraints, scheduling milestones, and managing stakeholder expectations. We crossed into new territory on this project with hungry beavers. lost quite a few trees our first season. So lesson learned is that challenges come in many forms, and nature should never be overlooked.
On a more serious token, the final total cost for the project came in below the dollar value identified in the Rocky Reach settlement agreement. During initial planning, the costs for proposed improvements were nearly double the dollar amount stated in the agreement. Chelan PUD staff worked with the City of Eniat Park Board and city staff to prioritize improvements and trim costs to below the agreed dollar amount. This required a good deal of collaboration through the design process and again during the construction to control the expenditures. Even after these significant reductions, the final product exceeded the stakeholder expectations. And the lessons learned is that consistent, meaningful stakeholder engagement is essential to achieving a highly successful outcome.
So I thought it'd be good to note that one of the items we cut during the prioritization process was to replace the restroom picnic shelter that were on the north end of the park due to concern of encountering cultural resources. During major park reconstruction, we held a large reserve contingency amount for a possible discovery. That contingency money is now being used to remodel the north restroom and picnic shelter. Those improvements are scheduled to be complete in 2017. So, yeah, we're really glad we were able to get that done for the city.
So we'd like to take a minute to thank all those who contributed to the success of the project. In particular, we would like to thank one of our retirees who's come back today, Chris Pominak, for all her efforts with the community prior, long before we started the project. And also we have with us Mayor Vredenburg. We'd like to thank the city and all their efforts in collaborating with us, and we had many meetings with them and city staff, and they were just a pleasure to work with, and it contributed to the success of the project.
Thank you. Any questions for presenters before I open it up for public comment? Is there any public comment on this resolution? Mayor Vredenburg. We don't know.
We'll try it again.
It's working. Commissioners and public and people here, City of Eniat and the community of Eniat would really like to thank the PUD for their efforts. If you go back in history, and I go back a long ways into the, well, a long time, 90s and plus before, and we always didn't have a good relationship. But due to the action of the board and the people that you have working for you, it's really changed. I want to go back before Court and Casey got involved. Our good friend, Mrs. Parlette, she was very instrumental. We had 15 community meetings from the year 2007 to the year 2013. So the community was really involved due to her efforts. To Jeff, thank him also. If you follow this, it would be really amazed, because working with the lands people, Tim Larson and his folks, we had land swaps, land changes. We bought some land, traded some land from the park to another place on the waterfront, and now we have an outstanding facility. In fact, this last summer was the first full year the city maintained and operated it, and we had estimated about $60,000 in revenue, and we are $92,000 plus.
Wow.
Way above. And we were a little late starting. We have a lot of requests next year for group campings. National Bass Fishing Association has approached us to hydroplane people. We're on the map now, so it's going to be really busy. But without the help of Court and Casey and all the meetings we had with all the people, I taught school for 40 years. I thought we had a lot of meetings. We didn't have a lot of meetings. We had a lot of meetings with the PUD folks, Keith Prescott and Ray Height, especially with all his good work. They were good meetings because we got somewhere, and the product just speaks for itself. So thanks to all from the community and the city. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. Did you say that was 50 meetings?
15.
Oh, 15. Okay.
Which is about 2 to 3 a year, which is when you talk about community meetings, they have to be organized and set up. They're very good because the community really responded. And the community has bought into the project big time because they are part of it being produced and made. So it's been a really good project.
It should give us great hope for our substation siting process.
Yeah, it was.
I think John and Chris has already been up talking about it, and so we're on the first leg. We've kind of found a site that I think we can agree with, but I'm glad we're starting early and not late on the project. So thank you.
Yeah, Keith, I feel a need to comment that it was 3-4 years ago. Been doing this 10 years as a commissioner, and 3-4 years ago, it was the first time I showed up at a meeting in INEAT, and it felt good. Yeah, we weren't there to break a promise, and that was a good thing. So thank you. It's a great project.
So once again, we only have one resolution left, and what is the desire of the commission on resolution number 12?
Well, since there's no more public comment, I do have a comment.
Okay.
First of all, I'm really excited about the picnic shelter on the north end, right, being upgraded. That's really cool. And it's just exciting to see the transformation. I've said this before, but I've probably driven back and forth from Wenatchee to Lake Chelan thousands of times from the time I was born until today, and that's a lot of years. And to see that transformation happen and be so beautiful and be so embraced by the community of Aniette is just really neat to see. I'm so happy to be a part of it. So, anyway, thanks.
Thank you. Want to work on this motion by itself or wait till after?
Oh, I think it deserves a standalone.
That's what I thought.
Go for it.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I move acceptance of resolution ratifying field work order, change order numbers 1 through 9, authorizing final acceptance of work performed under bid 30-01 with Hearst Construction, LLC of Wenatchee, Washington, and authorizing payment of retainage.
Second. It's been moved and seconded to approve resolution number 12. There we go. I didn't want to reread all of that. So any discussion on the motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried.
Thank you.
It's been a fun process. It's fun seeing, being able to help make people happy and successful, and those receipts blew me away.
Yeah.
You got something good there.
And it's a beautiful project. Absolutely gorgeous project.
And Chris Pomenak is beaming from ear to ear.
Yes. Yes.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. We have one resolution left.
And I will read this resolution, but you actually got the presentation this morning, so
okay.
I'm not planning to do additional conversation unless you want to. This is a resolution authorizing the execution of field work order change order number 5-01 and 6-01 for procurement of additional turbine and generator components for the 5th and 6th units under contract number 04-01 part B for the Rock Island B5 through B10 rehabilitation project with Andritz Hydro Corporation.
Commissioners, what is your desire? We had the presentation this morning.
You go for it. Yeah, your turn.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept resolution number 15 authorizing the execution of field work order change number 5-01 and 6-01 for procurement of additional turbine and generator components for the 5th and 6th units under contract number 04-01, part B for the Rock Island B5 through B10 rehabilitation project with Andritz Hydro Corp.
I'll second the motion.
Been moved and seconded to approve resolution number 15. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried. So we are now on to manager items.
And we have an important one. We want to talk some about the California Energy Imbalance Market, and we brought some of our folks who work for us from out of town to come in to do that. So we'll invite them up. Rob Davis and Brian Branshaw are going to make this presentation. So we have an emerging behemoth around us, I would say, in terms of energy imbalance market that keeps getting new participants. And because wholesale power is such an important part of our revenue stream, we want to give you an update on what's happening with this. And I expect that we're going to be spending a significant amount of time on this in the course of the next year or two.
Lisa, do you know where the presentation is? Did you pull it up?
It should be down at the bottom, under there. No.
I'm good, thanks.
Rob and I don't have any boards, and we don't have any music or videos. I apologize for that. This is, like Steve mentioned, this is an update. There's no board action that's required. But over the past 3+ years, there's been an expansion in organized markets. And we're going to talk about two specifically. One is an energy imbalance market. And the second is a regional independent system operator. And so there's been discussion about ISOs expanding, and we'll talk a little bit about both what an EIM is and what an ISO is. So an energy imbalance market is a within-hour market, and it's an automated 5-minute dispatch. And so, like Steve mentioned too, we'll probably talk about it multiple times. So it'll become more familiar as we speak more about it. But it's a complex algorithm that looks at loads and generations in a broad geographic footprint and tries to minimize the cost of generation to serve load. A regional ISO includes optimization both hour ahead and day ahead, and they coordinate planning and transmission, and it consolidates balancing authority. And I'll talk a little bit more in detail about each of those as we go through. So the stated benefits of an EIM are that it's cheaper to integrate renewable generation, you get more efficient thermal generation dispatch, and more efficient utilization of transmission. Right now, with transmission, it's sold on a contract path basis. So if there's a transmission line that has a rated capacity of 500 megawatts, you can sell up to that 500 megawatt limit. The EIM, it will flow transmission on a physical basis. So even if there is a path that's sold, if there's room on that transmission, it'll try to utilize that as well. I'll ask Rob to jump in here on any of the items as well.
So without getting too deep, how's that identification take place?
There are a couple of different ways it can be done in the EIM. One of the quirks of the EIM is that each of the participating utilities maintains all the responsibilities as a transmission provider and as a balancing authority. So they don't hand those over to the ISO. So they get to make their own determination about how that's how the available transmission is calculated. So the first utility, Pacific Core, decided that they were going to, their merchant function was going to donate transmission rights that it owned. When NV Energy came in, the second utility to join, they decided they would look at a system-wide availability and make that available to any participating resource. And a slight variation on that was when Puget Sound Energy joined. They did not have an interconnection with another utility, so they took a contract that they have on Bonneville's system and donated that through their merchant function to be available to other participants. Okay.
So there's been a created opportunity?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
And feel free to jump in with other questions. We'll go as deep or as high on this as you like.
Well, it won't be deep.
So as Rob mentioned, there's been a bit of an evolution in the energy imbalance market. And in 2013, Chelan participated in an effort that was really Northwest-centric. There was the idea to work with your neighbors and see if you could come up with a construct to more efficiently use transmission, how we could integrate renewables. And there has been really a national trend towards becoming less bilateral, less people picking up the phone and having conversations with each other, and a trend towards more automated trading and into smaller blocks. As Rob mentioned, Pacific Corp and the CAISO were the first to come together and operate an EIM in the West, and that was October of 2014. They added NV Energy in 2015, and then both Arizona Public Service and Puget Sound Energy came in this October of 16. And then meanwhile, go ahead, Commissioner, you have a question?
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm just reading it. I apologize. I was just saying wow about all the people that are joining and planning to join.
Yeah, so Idaho Power, Portland General, Balancing Area of Northern California / SMUD, Seattle and Seattle City Light have announced that they will join, and then Tucson, Salt River Project, Northwestern Energy, and LADWP are studying, and most of the folks that have publicly announced that they're going to be studying are leaning that direction, although no announcements have been made on those entities. So it really has been something that we've been paying attention to, and you see that folks are moving towards the energy imbalance market. So just a visual, if you look at the amount of load that is under the EIM footprint, it's substantial. And this doesn't have some of the folks, too, that have announced Seattle City Light and Bank SMUD would make that increase. So it's a substantial part of the Western footprint right now. So we touched upon it a bit, but right now most utilities run their own BA. So Chelan PUD is a balancing area, so we're responsible for making sure that the grid is reliable within our footprint, that that transmission is utilized in a disciplined manner, and that each BA balances its load and generation. There's two independent system operators today in the Western footprint, and that's the California ISO and then up in Alberta. So this is just a map that shows how different the West looks versus other regions in the U.S., and each one of these bubbles on the map are a balancing area, and in the West there are 38. So if you look at other regions, PJM, for instance, you know, a larger spot, but one BA. And so Pacific Corp and the Cal ISO announced that they intend to regionalize the ISO. And if that happens, it would be the consolidation of the BAs, which is a much larger step as far as commitment to each other than the energy imbalance market.
So, yeah, I'm just trying to get my arms around what that means if they regionalize the balancing authority. So then each individual utility that is their own balancing authority, they give up that. What do they actually give up, Brian?
So you would give up independent transmission planning. And so if you were one BA, your transmission planning would be consolidated. And also right now, you know, we balance every 4 seconds, and there's that would be consolidated into one BA. So that, it's, that's very perceptive in that, that if you do go to a regional ISO, then, you know, it is a loss of control. You know, you're handing that over to an organization and their governance and other issues. But it also changes how you transact in the market. Right now, again, we trade pre-schedule and hour ahead bilaterally. And so folks trade on a bulletin, electronic bulletin board, but you still match up with counterparties. The same thing on the hour ahead, you match up with counterparties. So if we are long or short and we traded on pre-schedule, we might trade with Idaho Power or Puget Sound Energy. If it was an ISO, your counterparty is that entity. It's all trades are through the ISO. So it would be a big step. And we haven't seen folks other than PacifiCorp signal that they wanted to join the Cal ISO, but that could be possible. And it's a large undertaking. And we'll talk a little bit about why it's complicated here in just a minute. But the reasons that folks are talking about regionalization is that with all the renewable resources, that energy imbalance market does give you some benefit that you get a bigger geographical footprint and you can share imbalance. The same argument is made for an ISO, and the benefits that they've published are even larger than the energy imbalance market. It also helps with large ramping requirements. With the additional penetration of solar, we see really large ramps, and a regional ISO could attempt to address some of those issues, and then concerns over curtailment. Those are three of the big reasons that folks argue for a regionalized independent system operator. And then I touched upon it a little bit, but there's increased efficiency with hour-ahead and day-ahead generation optimization, just as within that hour period, if you're trying to optimize the longer time frame, gives some stated optimization as well.
So California certainly benefits from all of that, but certainly from the ramping more than any other region, right? From the ramping.
Yeah, they definitely have the biggest renewable penetration, and you see some of that leaking into the desert Southwest as well. And so if states do come up with higher renewable portfolio standards. Oregon has a 50% target. And is it in 2040 or 2040? So you could see if that public policy transfers to other states, you could see some of those same issues. And again, the announcement on the regional ISO, that was April of 2015. We talked about it's consolidated BAs. Full market participation, which means day-ahead and hour-ahead transactions, joint transmission planning. The other one's common market rules, and that ends up being stacks and stacks of rules. It becomes a higher level of complexity. And even going from hourly transactions to 5 minutes, you go from one transaction per hour to 12 transactions per hour. So settlements, even on an energy imbalance market, it becomes a more complicated system. It's a complicated process as well, just because there's six states that if they regionalize the ISO, it would include California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Utah, and Wyoming. And to get state governments and public utility commissions to agree to rules is complicated, and then also just the difference of differing public policy positions, say California versus Wyoming. Yeah, they're not the same. So that process could be a 4 to 5 year process on how they figure out governance and rules. So it'll be interesting to watch. There's some legislation that is pending in the California legislature that would make some of these changes happen, and that's probably uncertain on how fast that will go. As far as Chelan, again, we've been watching the energy imbalance market since the Northwest effort started. We were very active in the meetings and were supportive once PacifiCorp made their announcement. Towards the beginning, maybe of the end of that effort. And again, I think we were hopeful that we could work with neighbors to create something that would be, good for everybody in the region. And then once CIFCOR and then Portland announced it, it began to phase down as far as something that would be viable. When we looked early on, the analysis showed a relatively small benefit relative to the costs to become an energy imbalance entity. It's a time-consuming and expensive effort, and you have to make sure that you get the benefits out of that. So we continue to monitor and analyze the EIM, and it's a changing landscape. One of the things that we were hopeful about when we were a Northwest entity is that the governance would be favorable to us and to our neighbors. The EIM Governance Board in the CAISO EIM has become a bit more regional, and so there is a representative from the Northwest. I think it's a 5-person body, and there is a Northwest representative. So as far as where we're at today, you see the number of parties who have made a decision to become EIM entities. There's an increasing amount of renewable generation, and it continues to change the dynamics of the market. We're going to do additional study work, and there has been additional study work over the last year to see how hydro responds to the energy imbalance market. We'll continue to see if there's an impact on liquidity as more folks go to the EIM. Does it impact how many trading counterparties we have? So we've also been a proponent of opening the CAISO EIM to external resource participation. And not to get into too much detail, but to date, to participate in the EIM, your balancing area has to join the market. We've been advocating that you should be able to participate with your generation and make that available without having your whole BA go in. And last month there was a FERC technical conference that Rob attended in Washington, D.C. We were a proponent of making that a potential way for us to participate. The public generating pool also helped form comments, and we've worked with them. And so we've been engaging FERC. But it's a changing landscape, and we're paying attention to the changes. And, again, we'll be back someday to update and give additional information.
So is anyone else supporting us on promoting this participation just with your resource only?
It's widely supported by all the marketers and their trade groups, also additional balancing authorities, primarily in the Northwest, Tacoma and us and other PGP members. But the marketing community is very much behind it. So Iberdrola, Shell, PowerX, and others like that.
Independent power producers.
Correct.
Oh.
Because it's largely the decision to join is made by the BA. And so a balancing authority can freeze out IPPs that are on its system mm-hmm. if it refuses to join or if it's unable to join.
Hmm. Are we still doing any 5-minute marketing through PowerX?
Right now, through the real-time agreement, we set the system up energy neutral, and then the capacities that's excess they can make available to the market. So we're not privy to see the transactions that PowerX makes, although right now the within our market is fairly limited in nature.
Yeah. You made a comment that potential independent producers could be frozen out. We're not at risk in that capacity.
No. If there's... say there's a gas-fired plant in somebody's BA and that BA chooses not to participate in the market, they don't have that access. Like Rob mentioned, if it's the BA, then the BA has the choice to say we at some day may join and then they can participate in that market. But if there's an embedded generator within that balancing area, they themselves can't make that decision to participate.
Or relatedly, our slicers, if we elected as the balancing authority not to join, our slicers wouldn't be able to use their purchase shares to participate unless this external participation framework was adopted.
Wow, so that could negatively impact us in a big way.
Correct, and we raised that point to commission staff, and I think overall they were it was an odd proceeding just the way it worked out on the dockets, but they were very receptive to the things that people were presenting, and they actually ran it in a very open way, so there was a good dialogue during the day.
And I think the speculation that we all worry about is how big does this market become and how much of the day-ahead and hour-ahead market moves into the five-minute market. If the substantial amount were to move, then we've lost liquidity in where we're selling to. So this is why we're watching it so carefully to see what's actually happening on the ground as these new entrants choose to go in.
I'm glad we're watching it. I'm glad we have you guys involved.
Good update.
Good information. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
It's a really special day when Holly and Rob and Ryan get to be here. And I was going to say brain trust.
That's the nicest thing anybody's going to say to us today.
That's right.
Well, we appreciate it.
It's a true statement.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, guys.
That's it for manager's items.
Manager items. All done.
Yeah, I think it's always interesting. Thanks, that Holly just kind of slides out the door.
one moment. Manager item.
One. I'm sorry, I missed one. Craig Weddle is going to give us an update on the renewable diesel program.
Oh, nice. Thank you.
He's been sitting here all afternoon. It's a good thing he recognized you.
And I, too, do not have any videos or fancy boards or music.
Pretty pictures, though.
But we have a really nifty...
there are... If we can... Please.
But we do have a nifty fact sheet on renewable diesel that Suzanne and Communications helped us with. And the purpose of this is that we'll go on the district website to present information to the general public that wants information or even has concerns about our use of renewable diesel. And we wanted to share this with you first before we do that. And so what I want to do is just hit a couple of quick high points of this. We've covered most of this information with you previously back in August about our testing of renewable diesel, and there's some new information about that that's really good news, and I want to share that. Just a couple of high points. And so just by way of sort of reminder here, as we talked about back in August, renewable diesel is an alternative fuel biodiesel type product that's a replacement for petroleum diesel made from animal fats and vegetable oils. The difference between traditional biodiesel and this product is this is a straight drop-in replacement for petroleum diesel. So you can run it up to 100% straight in your diesel equipment, which you can't with biodiesel. And we have been since last March doing a controlled test trial of renewable diesel in about 40 of our diesel trucks. We've now burned about 35,000 gallons of it through those 40 trucks since last March at 100% mix. So it's kind of the ultimate test. And we've had absolutely no problems whatsoever. So it's a good product. It's working well and drastically reduces our greenhouse gas emissions from our trucks. So you'll recall when we talked about that, the concerns that have been raised by some about the use or production of renewable diesel is in Southeast Asia, where most of it's manufactured. There's been some deforestation of rainforests to plant more palm oil, which was one of the main feedstocks for renewable diesel. And so the new information that we have, which is really good news, which is related to specifically that issue, and we've been doing some more research and wanting to address that for those who might have concerns about long-term sustainability and whether it's really good overall for the environment. And so I'll get to that in a minute. But what we found out is that Neste Corporation, which is by far the dominant producer of renewable diesel worldwide, in Southeast Asia has taken some really strong proactive measures to eliminate any deforestation of rainforest from their supply chain, basically.
Did you say Neste or Nestle?
Neste, N-E-S-T-E. Yes. And because of the actions, now we've confirmed that our local supplier, Coleman, that the ultimate producer of the renewable diesel we're getting from them is the Neste Corporation. So that's really important to us to know where it's coming from and who's producing it. Because there's middlemen in the process getting it to us, and so that's been, we've been able to confirm that, and that's really important. Because of that, now what Neste has done, we now are confident that our use of renewable diesel is not going to be contributing to any larger environmental problems in terms of deforestation or rainforest. So I want to. That's what's covered mainly in this fact sheet. It talks about what. Why we're considering renewable diesel, which, again, is really two primary reasons, is that we've got Washington State requirements by June 1st of 2018 to be running our fleet off of electric-powered vehicles or biofuels. So that's just a mandate that we have to comply with. It requires us to run up to 20% biodiesel. So this use of this renewable diesel gets us ahead of schedule in compliance with those state requirements. We can run it as low as 20% mix with our petroleum diesel and be compliant, but we want to run it higher than that because of the environmental benefits. So the second driver is significant reductions in our emissions locally to benefit our local environment. So. Fact sheet talks a little bit about that, talks about what is renewable diesel. We've covered that before. And then a little bit about the environmental concerns that have been raised globally about it. And then we get into, okay, what is our supplier, Neste, doing? And essentially, in 2013, they adopted no deforestation and responsible sourcing guidelines for their supply chain. So they've been doing that since 2013 and implementing that over the last couple, 2 to 3 years since then. Which basically puts requirements on all of their suppliers and involves field audits and reviewing their suppliers' practices to make sure that they're not contributing or they're not actually deforesting to plant more palm oil. Put some legally binding requirements on their suppliers, and ultimately, by the end of 2015, all of Neste's larger suppliers had committed to no deforestation principles in their procurement. They've done a number of other things. I'll let you read that. But they're making sure that they're not buying product anymore from farmers and suppliers that are doing that. So they've put other requirements, like requiring all of their suppliers to be a member of the roundtable of sustainable palm oil and other things. And then lastly, this last year, Clean Nights, a publication on clean capitalism, rated Neste as the 39th most sustainable company in the world. Hmm. Pretty big honor for somebody that's producing fuel. Not an easy accomplishment. So it just shows that they're really taking it seriously. One of the concerns I shared with you before was that it's more expensive right now because it's being shipped up here, and we were getting out of Portland, so it was running, when I talked to you in August, it was running about 60 cents a gallon more than the petroleum diesel. It's down about 50 cents now, but we're going to, planning right now to continue. We bought a small amount of it. We're going to continue our controlled testing probably through the end of this year. And then sometime after the first of the year, we're planning to make a full switch to renewable diesel in all of our fueling stations. Initially, probably a 50-50 mix because of the cost concerns, and it is more expensive. But the really good news is we've been told that starting in January, there's going to be a supplier bringing it into Portland, Oregon. Excuse me, that's where we're getting it in. They're going to be bringing it to Tacoma, Washington. So it'll be available in Iraq and Tacoma starting sometime in January. So we're waiting for that because we're pretty certain that's going to reduce our cost quite a bit. We'll be trucking it in out of Tacoma instead of out of Portland. So we're going to wait and see what the cost impact of that is, but it certainly is going to bring our costs down. And then we plan to start with probably a 50-50 mix. I anticipate it's still going to be more expensive at that point. But we think it's worth paying a little bit more, at least I do, for the local environmental benefits that we get from the reduced emissions. So sort of a balancing act with cost right now, but the cost will be coming down. One other note, just recently in the last few weeks, there was an announcement out of California that the U.S. Navy signed a contract for 11 million gallons of renewable diesel from a firm in California. So that's good news because it's showing more domestic production of this stuff. And the more of that happens, the more that the cost should come down for us. So.
Question. Yes. So, Craig, did you say that in your testing in our vehicles that you're using 100%?
Yeah, we've been running it 100%.
And no effect on performance?
None whatsoever.
Really? Because yeah. After you were last here, I went online and went on the internet and started reading about it. And of course, you can read anything on the internet. But that was one of the concerns, was performance issues with it.
None at all. It's running great, and many others have been using it longer than us in very large quantities throughout California and Oregon, and we've not heard of a single problem that anybody's had with it. It's a very good product.
Mm. Yeah. Good. Yeah.
Much cleaner, obviously.
And the price will probably be going down.
Yeah, it's come down a little bit since last summer when I talked to you, about 10 cents a gallon, but getting it more locally out of Tacoma and hopefully eventually having some production in Washington State. We're hearing rumblings that might be, people might be making movement in that direction, but it should come down quite a bit once we can get it out of Tacoma.
I can see it going in Quincy.
So now, without looking to get your your answer from Suzanne, is this diesel really green as it's portrayed on this the drip on the nozzle?
I hadn't even noticed that on. It's a nice touch. It's a nice touch, Suzanne.
That's a good one.
Yeah, we're excited.
The symbol
really,
is great.
Really excited about this. It's a great thing for our local environment and. Gets us ahead of requirements that we have to deal with anyway. And
so the 50-50 mix, is that with petroleum diesel?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Is there any cost differentiation on whether it's canola or palm oil in the mix that we receive?
None that I'm aware of. Neste palm oil was a couple years ago a very large percentage of what they're making was palm oil. Now the percentage of the palm oil feedstock for Neste is less than 40% of their total feedstock, so they've reduced the use of palm oil. We've been told by a supplier, Golden Gate, that's bringing almost all of the renewable diesel into the state of California, is they're not getting any palm oil in what they're bringing into California right now. I haven't necessarily been able to verify that, but that's what the importer has told us. So they're using less and less palm oil anyway in producing it, which is good. There's nothing wrong with palm oil. It's not an evil thing at all. It's just if they're tearing out forests to plant palm oil. Palm oil is a great feedstock for this product, but there's only certain places you can grow it, and that's in that part of the world, unfortunately. So
I've seen canola growing in the Columbia Basin.
Right.
Yeah.
Wilbur.
Yeah, I've seen lots of them.
There's a lot of it getting.
I know it. It's, there may be lots more.
Soybean and canola are the primary sources in the U.S.
Do you know if we're talking palm oil? I'm assuming palm tree.
It's like a palm tree.
Like a palm tree.
Yeah,
in terms of how long it takes to grow that. In comparison to, say, a canola, which you can do.
Well, from what I understand, that's one of the reasons why they use palm oil is the palm plants grow fast.
Grow
it's
faster.
Not palm trees. It's a smaller plant. But
smaller plant, yeah.
It grows fast, and it produces a lot of oil. So it's a good feedstock, but there's only so many places you can grow it, unfortunately. Right. So here it's canola oil and soybean are the primary, and animal fats.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate the response.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Okay.
Hey, well, I've got you. I think I might do two other quick updates on Alcoa. So I did sign the conditional consent agreement a couple of weeks ago, and I just let you know that the other part of that the pieces that needed to come together, including signing the amendments to the original contracts and some of the certifications that Alcoa needed to provide us before December 1st. That work appears to be on track, and so we're not anticipating any problems right now. And finally, I just want to give kudos to Suzanne Hartman and her annual chili cook-off. She had set a goal for $2,000, and actually we raised $3,900.
A little wow. Under $3,900.
Super. Good job.
Yeah.
That was a really fun event. It was cool.
Super. All right.
That's it.
Another form of green.
Yeah, you're right. Commission items.
I don't have anything exceptional.
Okay. I might start off with just a reminder for my fellow commissioners and Commissioner-elect McKenna that upcoming this year, we will be, beginning of the year, we always look at those external items that we want to focus on, be it Energy Northwest, APPA.
Associations.
All the associations. Mm-hmm. And I've talked with Steve about that. And maybe at our next meeting, by our next meeting, if we all sort of come forward with this is what I want to do this year, it would be helpful so we can start organizing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder if we can share chair rotation thoughts. To be
and we need to talk about that or think about that also, yeah. The chair rotation. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And
that's the only thing I have.
I think just Steve, a compliment to you and the staff that you work with. In Energy Committee had a nice report from Dave Ward on some potential.
I was going to cover that. Go ahead.
Go ahead. It's your committee.
I forgot you got it.
So. Yeah. In terms of the potential of looking at dealing with the whole issue of greenhouse gas reduction at lowest cost, combining those two. And I think it was a presentation that was received pretty much seamlessly with one, addition in terms of talking about, where is nuclear in that conversation. And I know that will be a topic of conversation. It was kind of, we'll see where it goes, but, I think it'll be part of the legislative package this year, as I would perceive it now as being perhaps sponsored by the, PUD Association or other places where it might be more effective to be handled. Well, that's, to be determined, but credit to the study and to the sowing of seeds. And very few things get received quite that gently. And it was, but I think people understood it, got it, and went, yeah. So, thank you.
I appreciate that. Actually, I'm glad you raised that because I think it would be, given the reaction that it got there, and I presented at PGP the same day that you were at Waputa, and I got a similar positive reaction there. We've got the tri-commission meeting with the delegation coming up here, and if it's okay with you, I'd like to present that material to them so they hear it from us, mm-hmm. because I think that it's going to get identified as a Chelan proposal to some extent.
Yeah, it'll have to have sponsorship, et cetera, at some point, and we'll be looking for those, and it'd be good to plant the seeds and let people ruminate on it and also get their line of sight on sponsorship of certain legislation, and I think that'd be smart.
I think Dave Ward and George Kahn both were very quick give you a whole lot of credit for a lot of authorship, because I think they both know the level of respect with which you are held in the association. That, now, by the way, we do have 19 new commissioners?
No,
15 new commissioners.
Two who, one due to a death, one due to an illness, were appointed. I think 8 who chose not to run and 5
were defeated.
Who were defeated. So I think there's a total of...
I think 8 that were defeated.
5.
Are you sure?
Mm-hmm. 8 chose not to run again.
6. And, well, anyway.
So I think that the total number is 15. Is the largest number of newly new commissioners that we've had, at least I know in 10 years.
Yeah, because you and I, we were in a large group, and there were seven or eight of us.
So in 7/8 about kind of where we are. So it's a significant turnover.
Educational efforts offered.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, we're starting.
Okay. What do I do with my agenda? Follow up on delegation. Have you done everything already?
Well, we've been through the list from the last meeting. Mm-hmm. From this meeting, I've got four. Specific examples of latecomer fees, the fees and charges presentation, and also the just making sure that we're clear about the 36-inch area around the meter base and how that relates to the fiber equipment. So we'll get you something back on that.
Yeah.
We also going to take a look at how we identify HDL load additions, what we're doing today, and what those opportunities for improvement are in the future. And then if we can, figure out how to integrate this question into the surveys, what percentage of our residents use the parks today,
yeah, the state parks. I would really be interested to see if we can get a handle on that.
So I just have a question for Steve. Steve, you've promised us a presentation on cybersecurity.
Yes.
What's the timeline on that,
we're
roughly?
We're going to do that one right now. We're scheduling it for the December, I think it's the 17th, the second meeting in December.
That'd be the 19th.
19th.
Or yeah. 19th, I'm
good.
Sorry.
Okay.
So, yeah, so the group is already working as an outline for the presentation.
I continue to get phone calls and emails about what are you guys doing about cybersecurity. A number of people have read Ted Koppel's book, Lights Out, which you might read it. I read it. So thank you.
And then
I tell them you're coming forth with a report. So.
Yeah, and that just answered a question I was going to say, ask about our December meetings, but obviously there's two.
That was our intent. Yeah. We have enough material. We think that we did think about whether to cancel that one because it's the week of Christmas, but
I won't be here for that one. Mm. So you're home.
If possible, it would be nice to finish early that day on the 19th so we can all head off to where we are going.
Right. We're working on understanding what resolutions we have coming forward in December to try to minimize the chance that we would have a whole ton of them set up for the 19th.
Good.
Can't make
any
promises about that because the work flows when it flows.
But, yeah. Right. Well, that's over the river and through the west of Grandma's house, and you got to be there when they get there.
I'm going south-south.
Just checking.
With them.
Interesting.
Oh, nice. Nice, nice.
Okay.
That's it.
That's it.
Anyway, thanks for doing that, Steve.
Mm-hmm. Any additional public comment? I somehow don't believe so.
Steve?
Any other matters that need to come before the commission? We are in need of a relatively short executive session, 15 to 30 minutes. Do you want to take a break before that executive session?
A quick one?
Okay.
Quick.
Okay, so... Following a short break, we will reconvene an executive session to review the performance of a public employee as authorized by the RCWs. So, to not last beyond 3:10. We're coming out of executive session. This is November 21, 2016. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Is there any other business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we'll stand adjourned.